This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are about to witness an evolution. On each episode, we will take a deep dive into the career of a legendary wrestling superstar, looking at all of the elements that led to and contributed to their long-term success. With your host, Andy Atherton.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to a brand new show here in the PTVN Wrestling Feed. I'm your host, Andy Atherton, and it's time for an evolution. Well, there's been evolutions before, there's been revolutions, there's been all kinds of oceans, so to speak, but what we're here to do is we're going to talk about careers, gimmicks, matches, gear, everything all into one, kind of like your one-stop shop for a career retrospective on a legendary wrestler and all the personas, the personalities, their matches, gimmicks, everything. We're going to break them down and kind of do it. And to do it, we're going to have probably their biggest fan in Place to Be Nation here with me to give them a chance to really talk about their favorite. And as usual, this is my first episode of a new show. I kind of have to go back and get my good luck charm, so to speak. He is my co-host on Year and Pop over on the Pop feed. And here on the Wrestling Feed, he is the co-host of The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, the co-host on Main Event, and also one of the gems of Jenny and the Gems, the Podfather, Scott Criscolo. Scott, thank you for joining me tonight.
Good evening, Mr. Atherton. This is good because I appreciate you letting me pop this fine show cherry because... based on the popularity of the guy, you can only get up from here. So in terms of who likes who, but no. This was a fascinating concept when you came up to me and we started talking about it. I'm like, oh, it's fascinating. There's always limitations and there's always, obstacles and, you got to find certain guys who've had long careers and, but I look forward to how this show is going to go tonight and go forward for you because it's a good chance for for fans to really, particularly younger fans, to really dive deep into a wrestler guy or gal who has changed so often and has had so many chapters of their careers. It's like a history lesson, and I think we've had a lot of fun with that. I think we're in a historical frame of mind here, Place to Be Nation, coming off the slow reveal of our huge greatest WWE match mega list on placetobenation.com. So I think everybody's in like a historical frame of mind. So this is fun. That was a good idea. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I wanted to do something different because I've been, been cutting my teeth on the Pop feed. And I've been over here. I've been lucky enough to be a guest on Main Event a couple times. Been a guest on the Place to Be podcast. So I wanted to do a show over here and I wanted to kind of go in my wheelhouse. We have so many review shows, we have reaction shows, we have your vaults and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to do something sets it apart. And it's also a special, I'm not going to do this show every week or every month. You're going to hear this, every so often. I'm hoping for 4 to 5 times a year. But I am a big fan of biographies. It's actually something I used to be part of my job, where I got to learn all about people and from their beginnings to their ends. And I think it's also fascinating for a history lesson and kind of go back because there are so many people that find this feed that weren't around, were now watching it, these matches and these errors on the network, and they weren't there to see every week the progression and the surprises, because there was no internet for a lot of the time, and there was no the communication and the spoilers, they didn't come out as often as they do today. For some of these guys, we're not like going back to like Bruno's side, but a lot of these guys or gals that we're going to feature on this show have had long careers that many of them probably started in the 80s or 90s. So that being said, and you're here tonight, and I think everybody already knows, well, also they can see the title on their podcast app, but you're here to talk about your favorite wrestler. And for those who don't know, in case there's two people that are listening that don't know, who is your favorite wrestler of all time, Scott?
Well, my favorite WWE wrestler of all time, and he's top two for me. And obviously, knowing me long enough, it's not a secret. It is indeed the boss, the game, the King of Kings, Mr. Levesque himself, Triple H. Okay. And my other favorite wrestler is Ric Flair, but it's kind of hard to – because when we were talking about which guy I do – this kind of show would not be easy to do with Flair because his persona never really changed. Again, he goes in eras. So if anybody ever, if anybody that does the show with you does Flair, that's more of a, you'd have to break it up into years more than gimmicks. So yeah. I wanted to do Triple H because he's changed. He personally, his character changed so much that I think it'd be a lot more fun journey to take. And this is very enlightening for me, Andy, because the last time I did a strictly Triple H podcast, I was locked in a dark room with good old Will and Dylan Hales, and I felt like I was being waterboarded. So I think I'm actually enjoying. I'm enjoying having someone with a little more objectivity to do this with. So yeah, I mean, here's a guy that's gone through so much in his. Jesus, if you start in 94, we're talking almost 25 years in the business. Well, longer than that, if you count his time wrestling for Killer Kowalski up in the gyms in New Hampshire. But at least 94 when he debuted in WCW, we're talking almost 25 years in the business now. So I'm excited because it gets me a little reminiscent of his older times that I don't really haven't really thought about that much. So so there you go. And it's the man himself. Love him or hate him.
All right.
Most people hate him.
So we're going to go back to the beginning. First, we're going to talk about your fandom, and then we'll kind of go and set the stage for Mr. Levesque. When did you first discover Triple H? I mean, we're going to go through his time, you know, in WCW also. I'll be very brief, but, you know, did you discover him in WCW, or was it when he came to WWF did you discover Triple H?
Well, once he was in the WWF in 95, I remember seeing him in and out in 94. So I'm like, oh, this guy's from 94. And his gimmick was kind of, but he slowly grew up the ladder for me as a guy that I knew I'd like, when DX kind of formed in late 97. Mm-hmm. The blue blood gimmick was nice, but I didn't like wrap myself around it. But definitely the DX gimmick did it for me. And then almost more when Shawn left, after WrestleMania 14 and Triple H took DX over on alone is when I really became a big fan. And his heel turn in 99, which I'm watching right now, one of my network chrono watches, is really when I jumped on the bandwagon, and I've been that far ever since. It's not that I dislike Sean. I love Sean. Sean's probably top five for me.
Yeah.
But I think I like DX more after he left than when he was there. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Maybe it was my Brett sentiment. I'm not sure because Montreal, like a lot of fans, left a bad taste in my mouth. My opinion has wavered in the 20 plus years since.
Just past 25, yeah.
Yeah, so almost 25 years almost. So, I definitely warmed up to him once he took over DX alone, and when he joined the corporation after WrestleMania 15 when he pedigreed X-Pac. I remember that swerve that night, and I was on cloud nine because earlier in the night he reunited with China. Well, we'll get into that, but yeah. There was a nice swerve that night on that show at WrestleMania 15 that kind of got me back in that really got me on his bandwagon, and I've been there ever since. And I try to be very diplomatic in debates. I think a lot of people at Place Be Nation playfully like to needle me. Because, you know, when the ripcord's pulled on me, entertainment flies. So I think people like to needle me a little bit, and I do it in the chats. My PIC does it all the time. I can tell when he types something that he knows is going to rankle me, because he might feel the chat's a little quiet that day or something. So I know he wants to throw a little jab in there just to get the thing fired up. And I love him for that. But I've said it many times on my matchless reveal. I don't care who – if you don't like him, that's fine. You're not going to offend me. You realize how many times, Andy, in my fandom that I've heard people insult Triple H and then turn to me and go, sorry, Scott. And I appreciate the respect. You don't have to apologize to me. I'm not expecting people, everybody to love him. Just, you know, don't act to me like I'm a dumb wrestling fan for him being my favorite guy. Like, that's where I get annoyed. Like, my wrestling fandom is tainted somehow or something. It's just – that's nonsense. But I've never let anybody – you know, opinions are opinions. That's what makes wrestling awesome. That's why the ballots were great, and that's why we have fun with these projects, because everybody has a different opinion. So the Attitude Era was my time for him, and then obviously Evolution and, you know, all his awesome theme songs. God, I was live in Brooklyn when Lemmy died, and they did the big announcement, and people were like patting me in the back, and I was it was almost like Lemmy was a member of my family. It was pretty funny. But anyway, we'll go through the journey. But I would say my time that I really hopped on his bandwagon was when he took over DX on his own after WrestleMania when Shawn left. Is when I really kind of latched onto him as a fan, and has been that way ever since.
All right, cool. So that's kind of setting the stage of setting the mood, I guess, of where you're coming from. But let's talk about where he came from. So born in Nashua, New Hampshire, July 27, 1969. You know, he trained under Killer Kowalski with such other wrestlers like Perry Saturn and China, who we would go on to work with later on in his career. He wrestled under, you know, in Kowalski's International Wrestling Federation under the name Terror Rising. That was in 92-94. So then he signed with WCW. He debuted as a villain, Terror Rising, which spelled the word terror and then rising. And then he changed his name to Terra, like Terra Firma, to Rising, R-Y-Z-I-N-G. He used that for a short time, and then he was renamed John Paul Levesque, given to his surname's French origins. He was asked to speak with a French accent, but not speak French. So that's also when he started his finishing maneuver, the pedigree, which we will talk about as well. So this was a short time. He had was teamed with Steven Regal for a little while when he was doing his kind of his blue blood thing over there with the proper British, I guess. They wanted to make him the American version. And then he, went over to WWF 95. But let's talk about his WCW run. So, Scott, what are your general thoughts on the gimmick? Was it just like another built, blonde hair guy coming out? I mean, I remember seeing him on WCW Saturday Night. So, and I think it was like a squash or something. But there was nothing memorable about it to me. I thought, oh, this guy is honestly kind of like a Shawn ripoff. So what did you think of
that? That's fitting, right?
Yeah, what did you guys think of him? What did you think of when he was his short stint over there?
I mean, it was an interesting time for WCW because they were starting – they were turning the corner. Of course, Hulk Hogan was there. Mm-hmm. So WCW as a company was turning the corner. And, they were bringing in this influx of young talent, and guys like Regal were there. And these would all be a bunch of guys that Triple H would end up being friends with through the years and kind of help them out in their careers and in their lives. Regal, one of the biggest ones, Goldust, Dustin Rhodes, the same way. But to me at the time, he was just another guy. Like, I didn't think anything of it. Yeah, I mean, he was just kind of a faceless jobber. Or, you know, not faceless, not a jobber, but like a, you know, like a Bobby Eaton or something, like just another guy that was on the lower end of the roster.
Yeah, like a lower mid-card kind of guy.
Lower mid-card guy, yeah, that just kind of, you know, was there and nothing to write home about.
He'll beat the jobbers, but he'll do the job to, like, you know, the higher guys, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. You know, we'll play, you'll hear his, he had very generic music over there, which you'll hear underneath this. You know, did he really have any signature? He really have any signature feud there for favorite match?
No.
Over there, right?
No. I mean, he did wrestle, and a lot of people forget this. He did wrestle at Starrcade 94. Mm-hmm. He was the second match on the card. He wrestled and lost to Alex Wright, Das Wunderkind. Das Wunderkind. I forgot how long. I wasn't sure how long the match was, and I'm looking on Wiki. The match was 14:03. Oh, I never expected the match to be that long. I didn't think the match was that long. Wow. I actually laughed when I just saw that. He was squeezed in between Vader winning the U.S. title against Jim Duggan and Arn Anderson losing to Johnny B. Bad for the TV title. So it's pretty funny. So that's really the only match you could really say that marked his time in WCW was the Starrcade match with Alex Wright. He had some tags with Regal on TV, but really nothing to write home about. This is pretty much it for him, was this match with Alex Wright.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that you know, kind of, you know, paid his dues, I guess, so to speak, over there. I mean, according to Wiki, you know, that match at Starrcade, that kind of is what would impress Vince to sign him. So,
Makes sense.
Like I said, he was just another guy over there. You know, had he stayed over there, who knows what could have happened? You know, whether he would have moved up the card over there. I mean, we're right on the cusp of the Monday Night War starting. So, what could have happened? So,
exactly.
Yeah. So he started using the pedigree. Now, what do you think? Where's the pedigree for you in terms of separated from Triple H? We know, but where's the where's the pedigree for you as terms of finishers?
Oh, it's a top five for me. Mm-hmm. My favorite finisher of all time is not the pedigree.
Okay.
My favorite finisher has always been the Stunner. Mm-hmm. I've always loved the DDT, Jake Roberts DDT.
Yes.
And of course, Flair's figure four has always been one of my favorites too. Mm-hmm. And then there's plenty of tag team finishers. I love the Heart Attack, Anvil and Hitman. I love the Total Elimination by the Eliminators in ECW. Oh, I always love that finisher. That finisher is fantastic.
Which Undisputed Era kind of uses. It's a kind of a knockoff or a different version.
Yeah, it is. It's a hybrid.
Yeah, like Doomsday Device also is one of my all-time favorites.
Exactly. Oh, I always love the Doomsday. Well, Road Warriors could be another, if you ever need me back in 25 episodes.
Maybe your next time you'll do a tag team. How's that?
I'll do a Road Warriors one.
Oh, that's so much fun.
So, the pedigree is the top five. I like the finisher. It's quick to execute. It's one of those moves that can, it's not like an RKO, but it's one that could come up on the drop of a dime. So it's a top five finisher for me, regardless that it's his. It's definitely a top five finisher for me.
It's also one that, you know, you can get a lot of heat or pop from the crowd just holding the guy before, you know, just get him in the position before you even drop him. I mean, there have been so many times when the place just goes bananas when he, you know, gets the guy and he underhooks and he stands there and the place just bolts up and then he wham. I mean, you know, we'll talk about it a little more later, but when he nails Daniel Bryan, when he turned to let Orton cash in, that was probably one of my favorite pedigrees of all time.
Yeah, that's a big one. Mm-hmm. I agree with you on that. Yeah.
All right, so he came over to the WWF as the Connecticut Blue Blood, billed from Greenwich, Connecticut, right down the road from where you and I are, actually. It was kind of a modified gimmick of what he was doing in WCW. Originally, his name was Reginald DuPont Helmsley. Doesn't really roll off the tongue.
That's terrible.
Apparently, though, that was J.J. Dillon gave him that. But apparently, he had asked to play for a name that he could play with the first letters, and they ultimately agreed to a suggestion of Hunter Hearst Helmsley. And now his introduction, that was back in the days, which something they don't do anymore, which I really wish they would bring back, but we don't have gimmicks like this anymore, really. But him, Razor, Smoking Guns, guys like that, where you would see them on the Saturday morning shows, just, you know, prior to Raw, you know, you would see these vignettes, and he was, of course, he was a Blue Blood, so he was always talking about proper etiquette and making fun of classless people. he debuted on April 30th, 1995, episode of Wrestling Challenge, defeating Buck Zumhoff.
Zumhoff.
Oh, okay.
Buck Zumhoff. He was a AWA displant. Listen to Jenny and the Gems. You'll know who Buck Zumhoff is.
Okay. Cheap plug. Then he made his pay-per-view debut at SummerSlam, where he defeated Bob Holly. And then it became a feud with Hog Farmer Henry O. Godwin, the great Mark Canterbury, culminating in an infamous Hogpen match at In Your House 5 season beatings. So I'm going to stop there. And I'm going to let you talk about, now the Connecticut Blue Blood, he comes over. This is right before you knew him. But you know, what are your general thoughts on this gimmick?
I liked it. I thought it was a good gimmick for the time, in that 95-96 stretch when Vince was still kind of playing it kayfabe to the vest.
Yeah.
But we knew that he was a good wrestler. He's very technically sound. He took out jobbers at a pretty crisp pace. He had the whole thing. He was definitely paying his dues in that mid card. It culminated with him allegedly winning the 1996 King of the Ring tournament. Of course, that did not happen because of one of the most infamous moments, speaking of kayfabe, getting shattered. And that was, of course, the curtain call, which took place at Madison Square Garden. Kayfabe broke, and he couldn't punish, you know, Vince couldn't punish Hall or Nash because they were leaving. He couldn't punish Shawn because he was champion. So in the immortal words of Triple H from his Blu-ray, Thy Kingdom Come, guess who got to eat all the plates of shit? He did. So 96, so the King of the Ring, gone, and it went to Steve Austin, and probably a good thing historically down the line because of it. Mm-hmm. But so 96 was a tough one for him, and he ate a ton of – he did. I watched all these Raws. What he had to deal with in the spring and summer of 96, I mean, he took a – he was getting his fucking ass kicked by everybody. And it wasn't until October that he finally he ate the last plate of shit because then he won his first title when he won the Intercontinental Championship. So it was a fun gimmick. It was a good spot in the mid card as a heel, and he had some good feuds, which we'll talk about in a minute. But he definitely, you know, was a good hand at a time when the company was kind of in a state of flux. So he was very stable in that spot.
Mm-hmm. So when you go back, you look at him. He looks like a snob from Greenwich at that time.
Yes, he did.
With his facial features, so to speak. You know how everybody says he does have a bit of a larger nose.
Schnozzle.
Proboscis. And just with that snarl and that disdain look, you believed he was from Greenwich, Connecticut. Not saying anybody from Greenwich. No offense to Greenwich, Connecticut residents, but you know, you believed that he was this like snobby Blue Blood, thought he was better than everybody else. Now, he also had a different valet every week, it seemed like, right? It was like usually local talent, so to speak. But there were a few, women that went on, especially Sable, right? Sable was one of his valets, and that led to a feud at some point. Like you said, he ate up lots of plates of shit. He feuded with, Duke the Dumpster Drosy.
Duke the Dumpster Drosy. Lost that feud.
Yes. Had a couple of different Playboy Playmates as his valets. Shay Marks and Tylan John. In fact, from the 90s. Sable was his valet at Mania 12. And after his loss to the Warrior, he took his aggressions out on her. And Mark Merrill debuted to start a feud between the two of them. What would you say of this time? What would be his signature feud out of all these?
Well, if we're going from 95 to... There's a couple of them. If you go from 95 through to, I guess you could say, when the Blue Blood gimmick ended, which would be around probably September of 97, there were two of them. One was Mark Merrow.
Okay.
was Johnny or you know, Wild Man. They feuded from, you know, April all the way into like November of 96. And it culminated with Triple H beating him for the Intercontinental title on that Monday Night Raw in October with the help of Mr. Perfect, who then ended up leaving. Mm-hmm. The other guy that I thought was a signature feud for him in this stretch was Mick Foley. Foley and who, of course, debuted after the night after WrestleMania 12. And they had a feud in the summer of 97. I was almost going to say Goldust, but that feud was solid. But him and Foley feuded between June and August of 97. As Mankind, Triple H beat him in the finals of the King of the Ring in 97 in Providence, where my PSC was at. The following month at Canadian Stampede, they had a 8-minute brawl in Calgary. And then it culminated right down the street from us, Mr. Atherton, the Brendan Byrne Arena at the Meadowlands for SummerSlam 97.
Which culminated with
– you were in attendance for the steel cage match and that mm-hmm. vicious door shot that China gave Foley. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the infamous – not infamous, but famous moment when Foley ripped his shirt off and did his boy Jimmy Snuka's elbow off the cage. So I would say his two signature feuds in this stretch – was Mark Mero and Mankind / Mick Foley.
All right. So after that, you know, we talked about the curtain call, and then a new group came to form. I mean, apparently though, I heard that at one point there was talk of, and this you mentioned Mr. Perfect leaving, that there was going to be a stable, and it was, I believe, it was supposed to be Triple H. Or Hunter Hearst, sounds like Steve Austin and Brian Pillman being managed by Mr. Perfect, which
that'd be fantastic. Would have been awesome.
That would have been a hell of a deal. That's your dangerous alliance WWF style. Oh, right?
I know. So, that would have been great. Mm-hmm. That would have been
tremendous. And then so a new group gets formed though, which was his real life backstage best friend Shawn Michaels. China, his then girlfriend, and the legendary Rick Rude, they formed D-Generation X, which is one of my favorite stables of all time. Now, this is the first. Now, there have been so many incarnations of DX, sorry, where members have changed and their focus was different, whether they were heels or faces. But this is the original DX where... Suck It and the crotch chop, all that came up. You know, this is feuding with Brett and the Hart Foundation and that stuff, and Triple H was wrestling against Owen a lot. So, talk about the formation of DX, Scott. What were your initial thoughts back then?
I thought it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I loved Shawn, and Shawn had turned heel after SummerSlam when he accidentally hit Brett with the chair in the title match with mm-hmm. Undertaker. And then he kind of pretty much told the fans to fuck off and he and Triple H in China formed this group, and they called themselves Degenerates, because this was Generation X. So they were D-Generation X, and they did a lot of fun stuff. They did a lot of fun little gimmicks, you know, the mooning people and doing the best was when they would sit on top of the stage. And they would, some match would be going on in the ring, probably Los Barriquas or some crap. And they would be holding signs that said, like, who booked this crap? I'd rather be in China. And absolute fucking douchebags. And it added a sense of, when you go back to the turn of the Attitude Era and the birth of it, I guess you could say, or the prelude to it in 1997, they're a lot to, I should be given a lot of credit for that, besides along with Steve Austin. Now, having said that, it also kind of led to Bret Hart's exit from the company forever. Well, not forever, but as an active competitor.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think when the music debuted. It was a while. Even though DX technically started like in probably late August, early September, I don't believe we've heard the theme until the middle of October, mm-hmm. like after Bad Blood. I don't think we heard the DX theme until like the middle of October. So they were DX, but they really weren't true DX until you first heard the "Are You Ready?" which was until probably mid-October. And I loved it. And of course, the Chris what the fuck was the name of the band? I want to say Chris Gaines, but no, that's not it. Chris Gaines was that's the fucking all that's the emo ego of stupid
Garth Brooks.
Yeah, what the fuck was Chris something band? The guy passed away. Of course, he would sing. They would sing the theme live at WrestleMania 14.
Are you ready? Hey, you think you could tell us what to do? You think you could tell us what to wear? You think that you're better? Well, you better get ready. Bow to the masters. Break it down!
I thought it was awesome. I thought it was needed. I thought it gave the company a breath of fresh air. And, you know, they were trying to counter the NWO, who at the time was, you know, and WCW was beating the shit out of WWF. So, you know, they were trying to do something to kind of counter that programming. And so it was a good effort. And, you know, I think a lot of people were slowly trying to get accustomed to it, but it started working for them.
Yeah, it was DX definitely pushed the envelope with, you know, the almost nudity, the, you know, they were, this was the classic, you know, be yourself but crank it up kind of thing, because you could definitely tell these guys were ball busters, you know, and they were just loving it, just being kind of being dicks, so to speak. There's no other way to say it, but they were
right,
you know. But everybody, you know, that was a time when the heels were getting cheered. You know, you come out as a heel and maybe you're booed the first few weeks of the gimmick, but after that the fans really start latching onto you, because they were, you know, they baby faces were not what people were cheering back then. And, you know, they were really, and it was really funny stuff. It was really, they were just having a ball, and that's kind of went through. And then, you know, of course, isn't this when Rick Rude jumps back over to WCW and appears on Raw and Nitro in the same night during this period of time? Is that correct? That also happened, right? When they were taping,
yes, that did happen.
Raw
he was on
every other week. One night.
Yep. So he was on a taped Raw. He was on a taped Raw with a beard, and then he was on a live Nitro, clean shaven. So, that was a little douchey, but
yeah. I'm trying to paint a picture of the time period with the jumps and everything like that. And
definitely. Yep.
Do you think now he would have ever jumped? I mean, I don't know his contract situation, and he's fairly early into his run. But you know, most of his buddies are there. One's about to come back, but. You know, I mean, Sean was, you know, being kind of a douche backstage from all the reports that, you know, he, at that SummerSlam, I believe it was that SummerSlam where he had the Outsider shirt on at 97. I remember seeing it,
97.
Too.
97, yep.
Yeah, I was, like, looking through, like, where we had good seats. We were on the lower level, and we were able to kind of see back into, like, you know, the roped-off area with wrestlers walking by, and I remember seeing Sean walking, and I'm like, I went up to Pate and I'm like, dude, what? Like, Sean's walking backstage with Outsiders shirt on. He's like, oh, I said, yep. So Sean then, you know, has a back injury and he's forced into retirement. And so that means, you know, the DX gimmick is going to go on, but, you know, there has to be a change in the group's dynamic. So he Triple H takes over the leadership and gets on the mic and claims that, you know, Sean is dropping the ball, all that kind of stuff. And probably one of the biggest pops I had heard in a while at that time was, you know, reintroduction of Sean Waltman coming, you know, when he left, he was still the 1-2-3 kid, comes over there, becomes
correct.
Six. Six-Pac,
WCW,
and he comes back, and now he's known as X-Pac, kind of combining D-Generation X and the Pac thing. The New Age Outlaws joined, which were a new tag team of Billy Gunn and Road Dogg, a couple of guys who weren't really doing anything, and they kind of put them together. It was Rockabilly and the Roadie. kind of. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
This, like you had alluded to earlier and mentioned, this is really where DX took off. This is where they were this was the NWO for WWE. This was the signature faction that was leading on television, albeit turned out to be a face faction. But talk about this time period now with Triple H kind of moving up the ladder and being the leader of DX now.
Yeah, and after the back injury, and what's funny is the New Age Outlaws had gotten together way before in the fall of '97. Mm-hmm. Billy was Rockabilly, and Brian Armstrong Jesse James was Road Dogg, but not in that sense. He was just Jesse James. And they had won the tag titles on their own in late '97. So when DX formed that night, they had won the tag titles back from Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie in the cage, and that's really when they galvanized because they helped and they stayed heels. Mm-hmm. But it was one of my favorite lines of a Triple H promo when you're talking about X-Pac, when he said, "You look to your family, mm-hmm. you look to the click." And even though you knew who the click was, you never heard them say the click. Like, the click in 96 was the kayfabe Shawn's like fan club, like mm-hmm. the click, not the click. We know who that is. But for Triple H to actually say the click on TV was awesome. That was another one of the things that kind of latched me onto him, was that he was kind of continuing Shawn's way of kind of dumping kayfabe and telling you what was real. And X-Pac came out, was pretty awesome. And then the Outlaws, who I had already liked. I loved Road Dogg at this point, too. Mm-hmm. So that night in the cage in, I think, what was that Raw? I think it was in Albany the night after 14. Everything changed. And it was awesome. It was awesome. And the run they would go between now and the following year would be amazing. And they would slowly turn. They were baby faces, but then we had a new heel faction, form or kind of adjust in the Nation of Domination. And we'll talk about another guy growing because when we talk about feuds and matches of this stretch, this guy's going to come up often. But this was amazing. DX Part 2 for me was the moment that Triple H was, for lack of a better term, handed the ball after Shawn quote unquote dropped it, which we know he didn't, but and this is where my Triple H fandom really started to kick in, because him leading DX was awesome. I had already had the original DX t-shirt when Shawn and Triple H and Rude were together with China, but then I bought like another three of them that summer. So my foot hit the pedal and my wallet got emptied. I had changed jobs in '98, so I got a considerable raise.
You never pulled the trigger on the jersey?
Nope. I was pissed. I always wanted to.
The one thing I still wear, because jerseys always turn to fit no matter if you put on weight or whatever.
I know, right? That's true.
Yeah. So luckily, I've been able to wear that to basically every show, with the exception of like TakeOver. I've worn my my DX jersey. I'm sitting there. I remember taking my kids to their first show. I got my son, I think, was like 4 at the time or so, 5. My daughter is 10. They're walking in. I'm this proud dad with Suck It. I love that jersey. Oh, such a cool thing and such a cool look for a wrestler too, by the way. So, but continue on. One thing though. Did you prefer the theme when it started with the "Are you ready?" like so, or did you just love when it came with the "Break it down"? Which was like your favorite?
I like the build. I like the build. Mm-hmm. I like the doom doom.
And they start messing with the screen and all that.
Yeah, no, I love that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they had to cut it when they would later in the night when they would have matches, just to save time, obviously. Yeah. But I did like starting from the beginning. I thought that was killer for me. Right. I still, hearing it now is exciting. It'll always be a top five In fact, I Jordan Duncan's old retired countdown show, I was on counting down my top 10 favorite themes, and this one was definitely there. Mm-hmm. So I ain't listening to it now.
What do you think of the change in gear? Now, he had the different – he was still long pants, right, at this point? He hadn't switched over to the –
Yes,
to the show. So he had kind of changed, though, like just kind of like evolved, like his it was more the colors had just changed, right? He was just wearing a DX color, so to speak.
Right, he was. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, what's your favorite match from this time period?
Oh, that's easy. It was actually on my countdown list. SummerSlam 98, Madison Square Garden, Triple H and The Rock in a ladder match for the Intercontinental title. Mm-hmm. It's in my top, just in my top 40 of WWE matches all time. The feud with The Rock, which would go in different stages over both their careers, helped both of them and got them to where they are now. And Triple H was leading DX. The Rock at the time was leading the Nation of Domination after he kicked Farouk out. It was just and that feud combined with Austin versus Vince was slowly starting to close the gap on WCW and Nitro. And of course, on April 13th of 98, the streak broke, 80 something weeks or whatever it was. That streak is broken. And I thought 98, the product was better. 97, they were even. But 98, I thought the WWF product was better. Mm-hmm. That's just me. And I've always said that the last high point for WCW was that July in 98 when Goldberg beat Hogan to win the title at the Georgia Dome on Nitro. And then 3 weeks later, SummerSlam at the Garden squashed that, and they were on their way after that.
Yeah.
So for me, and they would have a good match at Fully Loaded that previous month, two out of three falls that ended in a draw. I think it was a time limit draw. It was kind of odd for the Attitude Era. But when they came back and had that awesome match at SummerSlam, the ladder match, it marked time for me that this was the moment that these guys were about to pull the ripcord on their careers and go off to the stratosphere. So that match will always be special for me.
What about the parody they did? The imitation.
Oh, the parody is hilarious.
Of the
what do I look like? An aardvark? Woo! Oh, it's fucking amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Believe it or not, actually, Andy, it's funny you mention that because that was the same night as the Hogan Goldberg title match on Nitro, July 6th.
The Xbox. Dude,
so it sucks because
Mark
it gets forgotten by time. I know. Is Hawk Henry. How do you get your pecs to go all the way around to your back? Oh, so good. It's so fucking good. You know what? You got to pull that up on the network at some point. Mm-hmm. Somebody pull it up. It's just so damn good. And then later in the year, they would do a corporation gimmick, which was good. Not as good as the Nation one. The Nation one is you know.
That's
the Rock
time.
Just came from the bathroom. I ain't bacon. You should have smelled what the Rock was baking. Rock was bacon. Brother was bacon. Oh, it's just amazing. It's just amazing. Yeah, that's a moment that's also a moment that stands a test of time. Always will. Definitely.
Yeah, so DX says, have an air great run. And then talk about WrestleMania 15. The leading up to that, though, talk about back in January, Triple H gets turned on by China, and she joins the corporation. And then Triple H loses the cane after China interfered on his behalf, and she was thought to have rejoined DX. But later on that night, Triple H betrays his longtime friend and fellow DX member X-Pac by helping Shane McMahon retain the European Championship and join the corporation, turn heel in the process. He started to change his look, and this is really what, you know, he started started moving up to the main event now. He's above Intercontinental title now. He's going for the, WWF title. He's up there with, Mankind, Stone Cold, mm-hmm. Big Show, Kane, Davey Boy Smith was in then. So talk about the heel turn at Mania, and what was your reaction to that? Of him, basically selling out, so to speak.
I gotta tell you, I was thrown off. I was at my friend Mike's house. God rest his soul. Great guy. We were watching it together. We were all DX crew. Dr. G was the Stone Cold guy. The rest of us were all DX guys. And earlier in the show, there was the match between Triple H and Kane, and you know, remember China was in the corporation, so she came out and she helped Triple H win the match, and they reunited after she turned on him in late January, early February. And it never hit me like, oh, so China's back in DX. Never hit me that, no, it's in reverse. Triple H actually joined the corporation. That never crossed my mind until Triple H pedigreed X-Pac in that match with Shane. I was stunned.
I was too. I was like, are they like friends from Greenwich? Because, you know, you had the Mean Street Posse was out there too. So I was like, I was like kind of thinking like Greenwich connection there. But yeah. That was a heel turn. Like, you know, you think back, like nobody saw that coming.
No, nobody did. I was stunned. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. I was floored. But it was time for him. It was time. It's his time. No pun intended. It was time for him to move on to the next step. DX as a whole had run its course. Mm-hmm. As a faction, it was almost, you know, regardless of who was in it, the faction itself was almost a year and a half old. So it was time for it to kind of move on a little bit. Mm-hmm. So in that aspect, it was a smart thing to do. I was just floored by it. I wasn't expecting it that night, but it made sense creatively.
Yeah, he, you know, and also that's when he gets his new music. Corporate player and then higher brain pattern. Basically, my time without lyrics.
It was weird. Yeah, it was very weird. Yeah. I'm listening to it now as I'm watching. This is where I am on my WWF Chrono watch on the network, and I'm in late June, early July of '99, and it's fucking weird. Like, it doesn't really feel like his theme until we get to late '99, early 2000. But it was weird. But I liked it. In terms of the gimmick, if I may yeah, move on, no, unless you had something else, no, I didn't want to hop ahead of you. No. As I'm watching now, I gotta be honest, at least up until probably late July, from the heel turn to late July, I feel like he kind of got lost in the shuffle. He seemed kind of identityless for a while. He didn't have his own. He wasn't wearing his own T-shirts. He kept changing his outfits. One minute he had like jeans and a flipped over ball cap. The next minute he has like leather pants. It was really weird. Like, he was like Blair's borrowing people's clothes. It was very strange. It felt like he didn't the Rock face turn and then Taker winning the title and all that. And of course, you know, the whole company got rocked when Owen died. It just felt like for those few months after he turned heel, it felt like he got lost in the shuffle in the corporation. There were too many people in the corporation. I'll just put it that way. Mm-hmm. And it was good for – it was smart that they had, you know, Rock turn face because the fans were cheering him anyway. So it was okay for them to – they felt it was okay to cheer for both him and Steve Austin. The fans finally realized that. They wanted two heroes, and you had Rock and you had Stone Cold. But with Taker leading the corporate ministry and then he won the title and everything, Triple H definitely felt like he was lost in the shuffle for a good 3 or 4 months until kind of breaking away in July – and then getting the title shot in October, August at SummerSlam. So as much as the heel turn was necessary, he definitely got lost in the shuffle for those few months and didn't really have much of an identity. He was like, again, he was wearing either like generic WWF Attitude T-shirts. A couple times he came out in China's T-shirt, which is even more hilarious. He's wearing his girlfriend's fucking T-shirt, which is pretty funny. So I feel like it took – even with him turning heel – he still felt kind of on the back burner from late March when the heel turn happened till probably late July. And then he kind of elevated, moved up the ladder a bit when Rock started feuding with other people and then he started feuding with Billy Gunn. Triple H got into that slot to feud with Stone Cold, who had won the title back from Taker. And then he became then the game, because the game promo was right around late July when he said, the first time he ever said, I am the game. That's the first time he'd ever said that.
Yeah.
And that's when that stretch started, which was, I think it's the last Raw on the network. Heat. I think it was the last Heat on the network, which is late July. I think it was the night of Fully Loaded. Is when he cut the I am the game promo on JR mm-hmm. before Fully Loaded, which he was wrestling Rock. It was a number one contenders match, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. And then he
that's when things kind of evolved for him, no pun intended.
Yeah, and then he started feuding with Vince. He actually dropped the belt to him, and then that was a great feud. And now let's talk about the wedding. Because there have been wrestling weddings for years. I think this has got to be my favorite. Probably number two is probably the Billy and Chuck wedding, I would think. But this has got to be my favorite wedding because, Stephanie, we're talking about, is about to marry Test. You got the Hardys, you got Edge and Christian as the groomsmen. I couldn't remember who the bridesmaids are. And then one of the best wedding crashes of all time happens, and we go to the Tron, and we see the video, and it's Triple H with a passed out Stephanie driving in a convertible in Las Vegas at a drive up wedding chapel, and they get married, hence ruining the wedding of her to Test. What was your reaction there when because they had were they together backstage by then, or was he still
no. No, he was still with China. Okay. He'd be with China till, I think he'd be with China till probably mid to late. I think he was with China till late 2000. Because it says on the DVD that they really started to bond after he popped the quad.
Okay.
We'll get to that in a minute. But no, by then he was still with China. This was all just kayfabe.
So
he wasn't with Stephanie.
Yeah. So this is about. So this went on for about 17 months. First off, it starts as, she basically, they do like, what is it called? Like Helsinki syndrome, where, the victim falls in love with their kidnapper kind of thing, where she becomes slowly turns into the heel, starts basically dressing sluttier and all that stuff. And,
yep.
And
leads like Patty Hearst.
Yeah. Kind of leads to the McMahon-Helmsley faction. And also, he gains the nickname the Cerebral Assassin by Jim Ross. So, talk about the wedding crash in the McMahon-Helmsley era.
It was awesome. I loved it. Mm-hmm. That was that T-shirt I loved, the one that said "Not for the Innocent" on the back with the triple with the three H's in the oval. Mm-hmm. And his evolution, no pun intended, mm-hmm. as a as the top heel in the company and the champion throughout most of 2000 coincides with the influx of WCW displants. Mm-hmm. Of course, Jericho came in August. The Big Show was already there. And then obviously the big guys came in early 2000, Jericho, Eddie, Benoit, Saturn, Dean. The roster, Chris Kresge, who took over the writing after Russo and Ferrara left for WCW, Chris Kresge was handed a phenomenal roster in 2000, and there was some great stuff in 2000. And another match that's on my list, and I know it's on a lot of people's ballots, was the match he had with Mick at the Rumble at the Garden. Mm-hmm. Something about the Garden that brings out the best in people,
Yeah, I was at that one,
you
too.
You can appreciate it. You could appreciate it. Dr. G was actually at that one. I wasn't at that one. Dr. G was at that one.
That was a tremendous card overall.
Yes, it was. Oh, absolutely it was. The Rumble was a little – the Rumble itself was a little shaky, but the undercard was fantastic. You had Taz's debut. Mm-hmm. You had the Dudleys and the Hardys in the table match – in the tables match. You had this match. I just will never forget him being backdropped by Foley on the pallet, and then the extra on the Rumble DVD – is him having the pallet piece yanked out of his calf, which is gross. But I mean, that match marks time. The match at Backlash, where Rock wins the title and Austin came back. The following month, they had another match that I have on my ballot. The match you're gonna hear that a lot from me. Another Triple H match on my ballot. The Iron Man match they had at Judgment Day in Louisville. That match is fucking amazing. And then him and Jericho had a match at Fully Loaded, and then he had matches with Angle. That whole 2000 into early 01 is just a great stretch of good wrestling. I think that might have been Triple H's zenith as a pure wrestler. Injuries and other such things would take his toll, and then the work rate quality varied from guy to guy. But this 2000 is a stretch where easily Triple H, and I believe PWI named him Wrestler of the Year in 2000, and he earned it because he worked his ass off all year long against everybody. And putting guys over and guys helping him get put over, and just an amazing stretch. I will always say that this incarnation of Triple H from December 99, when he pretty much hooked up with Steph, on camera, not off camera,
yeah,
until the quad pop in May of 01, was the best stretch of wrestling that Triple H ever had in his career. He would never be the same when he came back in 02. We'll get to that. But this stretch is where his wrestling was at his best. He was in shape, maybe medicinally helped. Not maybe, he was. I don't deny that. I'm not I may be a fan, but I'm not an idiot. it's hard to argue that this chapter of his career was the best wrestled part of his career. All of his matches were killer, and he had good opponents, but he gets a lot of credit too. So if you want to talk about the best stretch of his career in terms of in-ring, it's this one, from when he hooks up with Stephanie on camera in December of 99 until the quad pop in May of 01. He's amazing. Amazing. And in early 01, another match. Guess what, Andy? Another match on my list is the match from No Way Out in Vegas in 2001. You have to listen to my reveal show to figure out where I have it. Him and Steve Austin, the Three Stages of Hell, which is just perfect. Now that stretch there, the Rumble No Way Out in WrestleMania 17 is when WWF was at its peak, absolute peak of a company. The roster was perfect, and he was a big part of it. So. Mm-hmm. So just to kind of help you answer your questions, the best feud was The Rock, in that stretch. The best match is definitely the match with Austin at, the two of them. It's kind of a tie, him and Foley at the 2000 Rumble and him and Steve Austin at No Way Out 01 in, Vegas.
One, two, is this on? Yo, Jimmy, hit me with that Triple H.
And what do you think of the music at the time? Now that was when my time.
Oh, that theme is my favorite. Mm-hmm. It's my favorite. It's my favorite. Well, it's my favorite of his solo themes. Mm-hmm. That may give you a hint as to what my favorite theme is ever.
Yes. And then, he goes over to the short tights in this period of time.
Okay. Yeah, he goes to the short tights by like June, mm-hmm, of 99. He goes to the short tights. He has the short tights pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So he has the short tights a couple months after he turns heel. So like June of 99, he starts wearing short tights.
Yeah, I mention that because, he does the whole thing with Rikishi. It turns out that he was paying him to run down Austin to get Austin off, yep, TV, and then he fused with the Undertaker, and then he joins forces with Austin, and they become the two-man power trip, and they end up feuding with the, I guess we were jokingly calling them the Canadian Chris's at the time. Benoit and Jericho. And I remember I was watching this show live, you know, he comes down. It's May 21st, 2001. We mentioned it earlier. They were defending their, they were the tag champions, actually, him and Austin. And Jericho had Austin in the Walls of Jericho, and Triple H ran in to break it up. And as he did, he suffered a tear. I mean, he steps, and you see that thing pop. I mean, you...
Oh, it rolled.
Yeah, you just see that pop.
Yeah, it rolled.
And for the guy to finish the match, and take a Walls of Jericho, no less, with a pop quad. You know, now, you know, we've had other people popping quads, like his father-in-law, you know, popping both quads. If I get me in the ring, sit down. But, you know, that's got to say something about this guy's toughness. And, you know, he had to go to the famous Dr. James Andrews, and he got a, you know, he got a fix. And that kind of brings the end to the McMahon-Helmsley era. It brings the end of the two-man power trip. So where does he go from here? Scott, you know, we're gonna talk about that shortly.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first show, working out the bugs here. But, you know, we're going to take a break, allow Scott to collect his thoughts, because we're going to get into the, I guess, the second half of Triple H's career and talk of where he kind of evolves a bit more. So stick around with Scott Criscola. I'm Andy Atten. We'll be right back. Place to Be Nation, welcome back to the evolution of the game, Triple H, here on the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed. I'm joined by the Podfather, Scott Criscola, as we discuss the career of Paul Levesque, otherwise known as Triple H. We left off at his quad injury after the McMahon-Helmsley era and the two-man power trip, and we're going to continue looking at the career of the game. But first, let's kind of like talk about what's going on here and other great shows you can check out here on the Wrestling Feed. We got the Place to Be podcast. That is the mothership here at Place to Be Nation, mm-hmm. where Scott and Justin, they co-host, and they take you through the chronological history of the WWE in terms of the big shows, the televised, you know, builds and that stuff, all the pay-per-views, main events, MSG house shows. So check it out. The main event, which is also co-hosted by Scott Criscola, with the Godfather, Nate Milton, and the Conscience, Steve Willey. They break down all the current events in the world of wrestling. Row 1, Seat 1, an interesting look in the world of small-town wrestling and beyond with host Ben Zani, welcoming a variety of guests every other week, talking WCW. Heads to Center Stage Theater, where Tim Capel, Greg Phillips, and Jennifer Smith pay tribute to the legendary promotion from the Dirty South. Body Press Your Luck, a wrestling game show hosted by JT Rosero and Jordan Duncan, which I am also a featured player on. Well, I don't play. I'm more the scorekeeper, time person, third man to booth. In case
Johnny Olsen.
Yeah. In case of injury to either, I will step up.
Emergency quarterback.
I'm the punter. I'm the alternate. They call me from the practice squad. with this ring, and which husband and wife Ryan and Cindy Everett discuss specific matches in their respective fandoms. You Don't Know Billy Jack, where Drew Wardlaw and his friend Jordan watch and discuss some of the greatest pro wrestling matches of all time through the eyes of non-wrestling fans in the search of a universal connection in pro wrestling storytelling. Plus, don't forget, we have WWE pay-per-view reaction shows and semi-regular shows with Jenny and the Gems, which feature Scott, PTB NXT, Adams Division, Special Relations, and don't forget, check out the Pop Feed, which is delivered with great content, which is my primary home here at Place of Nation, featuring great shows like The Year in Pop, which Scott, you co-host with me, Laughing Theater, which is one of my shows, DC For You, Marvel Age, Brother Sister Rewatch, Great Debate. There will be more great debates coming to this feed as well, but we'll talk about that at the end of the show. A soft plug, as Tim Capel likes to call it. And also, don't forget, the Jenny Position, which is another great feed featuring, is the home of Keek and Sassy, talking pop, freak out driving, telling stories. The Journey Through Infinity, which features you, Scott, as well. So check out all the great feeds that we offer here between Place of the Nation and the Journey Position. And there's a little something for everybody. All right. So let's get back, though, to what we're talking about. The game, the King of Kings, the Cerebral Assassin. Many, many monikers for the great Triple H. So, Scott, so we're left off around 2002, where Triple H returns from his injury. He comes back as a face at Madison Square Garden. He wins the Royal Rumble and then received an undisputed WWF Championship match at WrestleMania 18, where he defeats Chris Jericho. And then he dropped the title a month later at Backlash against Hulk Hogan. And then he becomes exclusive to SmackDown due to the draft and continue to feud with Jericho. So, what do you think about this time? Now, this is a new Triple H. You know, he's a face. He starts off with, this is where the game, the song comes in.
Time to play the game. Time to play the game.
You know, which is probably one of, you know, we talk about great theme songs. Probably one of the best, to me, great entrance themes. Most of them have like that first hit. And when you hear, you know, doo-doo, time to play the game. You know, that that hit. I get chills when I hear it, because it was just like, you knew shit was going to go down. And it was like some serious, you know, water spinning happening shortly. So talk about Triple H's return now from the quad injury.
Well, it's amazing that he literally missed the entire invasion. Mm-hmm. Probably better off than that. But
yes, that's true.
He came back that January 7th. At the Garden, and it's I mean, I can't lie. It's probably my favorite personal Raw moment. It's not the greatest Raw moment of all time, objectively, but subjectively, it's my favorite Raw moment of all time when he came back that night at the Garden. It was just amazing. And then he beats the shit out of Kurt, drops him with a pedigree, announces that he's going to the Rumble, and that was a big deal. That 0-2 Rumble was fun. Because there's a thing. The bonus at the time of having Jericho as champion, all of the studs of the company all were in the Rumble. So you had Austin, Rock, Rock was in the title match, but Austin, Triple H, and Angle, and Taker, and all, like Kane, and you know, and then the surprise Mr. Perfect, like all of the big heavyweights were in the Rumble. So it was probably one of the most loaded Rumbles of all time. Because you had a guy like Jericho as champion, only Rock was not in the Rumble. So the Rumble was able to have all these other guys that normally wouldn't be in it because they were champion. Oof. It was amazing. And then I remember him losing the No Way Out match to Kurt Angle, which means he lost his title shot, got it back on Raw. And then, you know, Andy, you've been a wrestling fan a long time. You know that there's the death spot on a card, you know, where like the crowd is, you know, that's where everybody takes a spell. Well, it's kind of amazing that the main event of that show was the death spot. Because, of course, WrestleMania 18 in Toronto was, of course, remembered for Hogan and Rock. And poor Jericho and Triple H got buried. The main event was just and the match isn't terrible, but the crowd was fucking cooked by then.
Yeah, I remember watching that. Just talk about Hogan Rock quickly. Hogan Rock, you know, that was 2002, so I am 30 years old. Watching that match, I felt like I was 12, 13 again. That was like,
yep,
that put you back to being a young wrestling fan, because you had no idea what was going to happen.
Nope, you're absolutely right.
So
yeah, it was crazy.
Sidebar, sorry. So go back. So then, so 2002, right? And
It's crazy. I agree with you 100%. That Hogan thing got me. It almost made me forget about the main event. I mean, we all knew Triple H is going to win.
Yeah.
And then a month later, he got caught in the undertow of Hulkamania. And you're right, he dropped the belt the following month at Backlash in Kansas City to Hogan. And then that's when Triple H's face turn started to get a little lukewarm.
Mm-hmm.
They had a great him and Jericho had a great Hell in a Cell match at Judgment Day. Then he had a bad title match with Taker at King of the Ring in Columbus. That match is not good. It is so boring and cumbersome. And this is where I was saying, Andy, that now you're starting to see kind of Triple H break down a little bit. He got a little too over-gacked. He looked like a fucking triangle. He was shaped like a Dorito when he came back.
Mm-hmm.
He was literally an upside down fucking triangle because he couldn't work out his lower body because of the injury. So he worked out his upper body and he was fucking loaded.
Yes.
To the gills. And not in a good way, I have to admit. At Vengeance, he doesn't wrestle. It turns out he was choosing between the two shows. Sean wants him to be his manager. This is where that happens. Sean wants him to be his manager, and then the night after on Raw, he joins Raw, and then he pedigrees Sean and gets pissed off.
Yes, that's right.
That leads us, if I may continue,
yes.
That leads us to guess what? Another match on my count, on my reveal list. The hits just keep on coming. And that's the match. Andy, we've talked about this on a ton of other wrestling shows. I think you actually asked this on one of the great debates that you were with us on Main Event.
Mm-hmm.
When you said, like, show that you wish you could have gone to in hindsight and didn't.
Yeah.
I think you would ask that.
Might have.
And that we could have, that we should have been able to. I don't know why the fuck I did not go 45 minutes to Nassau to see SummerSlam 2002. What kind of fucking idiot am I? That card was loaded. And it turns out that one of my favorite matches ever is on that show, and that's, of course, the street fight. Shawn Michaels made his huge return after 4.5 years and took on Triple H and, of course, won the match. And that match is one of my favorites ever. You'll listen to the reveal, and you'll see where I have it on my list.
Yeah.
That match kind of got Triple H back sort of into the swing of things. But as we will see, we did the brand split.
Mm-hmm.
And the big brand split happened. And Brock Lesnar, who was the WWE champion, went to SmackDown. So Raw had no belt. So out comes Eric Bischoff, the GM, and he pulls out the Halliburton. And there's the big gold belt, the World Heavyweight Championship, which had been retired after WrestleMania 18 months earlier when Ric Flair, who at the time was the GM of Raw, debuted a new belt, which now is in Brock Lesnar's possession, which is a cool belt, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finishes the year as world champion. He gets Ric Flair as his manager, which was a lifelong dream of his. This is where we get to the Triple H wet dream part of his career, which we'll talk about in the yes. next. We'll talk about in the next chapter. This is like the wet dream Triple H. Mm-hmm. No jokes out there, you. Did you go to Survivor Series 02?
Yes.
At the Garden?
I was at that.
You were at that show? I think Justin was at that show, too. I didn't go to that show.
Mm-hmm.
That's, of course, the first – that was when the Elimination Chamber debuted.
Yes.
And Shawn Michaels won that match with his terrible hair and those weird-looking brown tights. And then it concludes with – then the year concludes with the – with the match in Armageddon, the three stages of hell. So 2002 was a up and down year for him because he came back hot in January, went through the feud with Jericho, won the Rumble, won the title at WrestleMania, and then things got a little wonky. Hulk Hogan, big shot, kind of wonky things up creatively a little bit, and then kind of went back and forth.
Well,
and Triple H is just a better heel anyway.
Well, one thing we can't gloss over, though, is his feud with Kane. In October of that year. Yeah, we mentioned all the high points. We got to mention some of the low points.
Yes, we do.
And this is probably one of the most, worst or frowned upon angles or feuds. Of course, we're talking about the Katie Vick stuff. Triple H claimed that Kane had an unrequited relationship with a woman named Katie Vick. He went on to claim that after she was killed in a car crash. Rory, Kane, the driver, raped her corpse. He then threatened to show video footage of Kane committing the act in question. However, the footage that finally aired showed Triple H dressed as Kane, simulating necrophilia when a mannequin in a casket. Kane's tag partner, the Hurricane, responded the following week by showing a video of Triple H, rather someone wearing Triple H series of masks, getting an enema. The angle is very unpopular, as we've said, and was de-emphasized before the title match. Triple H went on to defeat Kane at No Mercy, unifying the two titles. So, you know, not everybody's got, you know, everybody's got bad angles under their belt, even when they're at the top of the card. So, yes, he then, you know, lost it to Shawn in the first Elimination Chamber, as you talked about. And then the Three Stages of Hell match comes. So, so what'd you think of The Game as the song, by the way? We talked about this. I know this is probably one of your favorites on your list.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. It's awesome. Oh, no, it's awesome. I also have to, and I'm, you're being quite right, Andy. We do have to talk about the lows. The Jericho feud leading to WrestleMania 18 is not the greatest either, because they were feuding over, you know, apparently on camera, him and Stephanie were getting, quote, divorced.
Yes.
And he goes, and it is one of my favorite lines when they do the vow renewals, and he goes, "I have found you something for what you truly are. A no good lying bitch." That was great. And he beats the shit out of Vince. Oh, it was fucking great. That was another great, awesome wedding moment in the ring. Mm-hmm. But that whole thing with the dog Fifi or Lucy, the dog Lucy, and the fucking stuck to the tizer to the like National Lampoon's Vacation under the fucking bumper, and the whole thing was fucking nonsense. It really cheapened what could have been a great feud between him and Jericho heading into WrestleMania. So. Not just the Katie Vick. I mean, the Katie Vick just visually was just cringing. Mm-hmm. But sadly, the feud with Jericho was not nearly as good as it should have been. So there does have to be a knock on that. But the Katie Vick stuff is just – as great as the Shawn feud was in 02, that's a down point in 02. That Katie Vick moment was just thoroughly unpleasant.
Yes. And then
– but the Game is a great theme song. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then we get into what you refer to as the wet dream. Now, do you think Triple H, growing up, you know, wrestling fan, do you think he wanted to be a horseman one day?
Yeah. Oh, I definitely think he did.
So he got his wish. No. He got his wish with Evolution, basically, the WWE version of the Horseman, which was, you know, him, his hero, his mentor, Ric Flair, and then a couple of guys on the upswing of their careers, Randy Orton and Batista. Now, Rick is another one of your favorites. So, what do you think of this when you saw this coming together? What was your initial thoughts, your reactions?
Kidding me? heel stables, sign me up every day of the week. Mm-hmm. This was a good moment for Triple H because it was time for him to now be like the Flair. And, you know, it was kind of like he was the Flair. Flair was like Ole. Batista was like Arn. And Orton was like Tully in that aspect. And it was the one thing that may have saved what was a rough 03 for Raw, because I said this many times on my reveal, and JR and I talked about it back when we were doing the original Vintage Vaults. 2003 was a year of two different brands. Raw was the superstars brand. SmackDown was the wrestlers brand. Mm-hmm. Of course, the SmackDown Six: Edge, Ray, Kurt, Benoit, Eddie, and Chavo. Whereas Raw had all the top flight, you know, money superstars. But the work rate left quite a bit to be desired. But I loved Evolution. It was a good spot for Triple H for him to have to be like the head douche in the Horseman in Evolution, and having all these young studs under him and having Flair the mentor. It was a perfect setup. Perfect setup. You knew he wanted it. Horseman fan as a kid. He wanted his own Horseman. He was going to get his own Horseman by hook or by crook.
Yes.
And this was the good perfect time to get it. Because Raw, you know, was kind of his domain now, and he could, you know, they needed to kind of beef up the mid card. So this was a good spot for him to do that. Was everything perfect? No. We'll get to that in a minute when you bring up matches and stuff. But in terms of Evolution as a whole, it was a great moment. It was a great moment.
Yes.
And a good creative moment, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, awesome theme. Again, Lemmy's back. That was Triple H's guy, and this was an awesome theme. You know, just that build. And you saw these guys; they came out in their suits, and you just knew that these guys were on another level from everybody else. And that was really how they presented themselves, and that's really how the fans perceived them. You know, it did wonders for Orton and Batista, who were great, but this really elevated them. You know, they talk about getting a rub. They got a rub and tug, you know, from Triple H and Flair. So
I agree with that.
So, so he had he held the World Heavyweight title for most of 2003. He successfully defended against Booker T at WrestleMania 19, where he held the title for 280 days, and he lost it to Goldberg at Unforgiven, which had a retirement stipulation on for Goldberg. And then he started, he gained it back at from Goldberg in a triple threat match with Kane at Survivor Series later that year. And then he defended against
Armageddon.
He failed to win it back at Survivor Series.
Right, yeah.
So then now that leads him to WrestleMania 20, which you were at, and I was at also, where he lost it to Chris Benoit in a triple threat match involving Shawn Michaels. So talk about this period of time. What's some of your signature matches, his best feuds of this period?
Was not one of Triple H's fondest years, unfortunately. The highlight of Triple H was when he got into his Ric Flair stretch of having to wear different colored tight boot outfits. For years, he just wore blue, just wore black tights, black boots with his logo on the boots. But then the Rumble, he wore red. And that is probably, I won't say it's my favorite match, obviously. But that Rumble match with Scott Steiner, Mr. Rotella was at that show, actually. The 03 Rumble was in Boston. That match is arguably the most hilarious pile of crap in the history of wrestling. Sadly, the following month at No Way Out, they do the exact same match and nobody's laughing. That match is so bad and bad, like insultingly bad.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to do a Scott Steiner episode. I don't think so.
No, you could have, tag team Scott Steiner and then juiced up Scott Steiner. It's kind of two parts there. Anyway, 03 was rough. 03 was rough. Then you have the purple tights. If I had to pick a match in this, say, I guess the stretch would be between February of 03 when Evolution started, and probably I would say April of 05 when Evolution officially ended when he lost to Batista at WrestleMania. I like the match with Kevin Nash in the cell at Bad Blood 03. It's not a bad match. It's not great, but it doesn't suck. The whiff, and this is a whiff, Goldberg should have won. Instead of winning the title at Unforgiven, Goldberg should have won the title in the chamber at SummerSlam and just should have cleaned through everybody. Mm-hmm. And instead, Triple H, and this is a bad creative decision by him, he wanted to beat – he wanted him and Goldberg to have a one-on-one match. And I thought that was a dumb idea. He should have just had – and then Triple H should have just got his clock cleaned at the end. Now, if you remember, Triple H had the infamous bike shorts on because he had a pulled quad or torn groin. So there was a lot of creative mishaps in this stretch and in-ring mishaps in this stretch. He would right the ship in 04. He would wrestle Shawn a few times. Obviously, wrestle Benoit a couple times. They had a great Iron Man on Raw. They would have a singles match at Vengeance in Hartford, although I was not there. And then they would have the weird feud with Orton when Orton would leave, when he would beat Benoit at SummerSlam. And then, you know, Triple H would do the infamous thumbs down. This was an odd stretch. Mm-hmm. What's that? No, I'm sorry.
Oh, what'd you think of that when they turned Orton facely face?
It was bad. It was bad. Orton didn't have that. I think they jumped on the Orton bandwagon a little too fast. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was quite ready for that moment yet. Whereas with Batista, that grew very slowly because it was organic. The Orton turn didn't feel organic. It felt like they wanted the belt off Benoit, not for any particular reason, because that wouldn't, no, those issues wouldn't come up for a couple more years. Mm-hmm. But I feel like they had to get the belt off him, and Orton was like hot at this point, but not hot enough to carry things. And it was rough. It was rough. And eventually he'd just go back to being a heel by the, you know, beginning of 05. So mm-hmm. It didn't last very long. Whereas with Batista, it was much more organic. Batista had that kind of smooth, like, you know, smirky way of about him that was kind of gaining him a stature with the fans without really having to try too hard. Like, Orton clearly tried too hard.
Yeah.
And it failed. Didn't happen with Batista. Batista, it happened very organically. And, you know, we'll get to Batista in a minute, but It was a fun stretch in terms of just watching some really ugly stuff. but he made up for it in 05 with the trilogy with Batista. And by the way, the third match of that trilogy is on my reveal ballot. And that is, of course, the last. This is great. Don't you love all this cross-plugging? It's tremendous. The match at Vengeance in Vegas, the Hell in a Cell, is one of my favorites of all time. It's in my opinion, it's my favorite Cell match. Then he took time off.
Yeah.
After losing at Vengeance to Batista, he took time off, came back, and this is another stretch I really want to get into, Andy, because this is another one of his wet dreams. He came back at Raw Homecoming, if you remember.
Yep.
The first Raw back on USA after 5 years on, oh God, TNA. It was named like three different fucking things in those 5 years.
I was actually freelancing there at the time, the National Network.
It was the National Network, and then it, of course, became Spike.
Yep.
But then they went back to USA in October of 05, and Triple H came back, and he gave Ric Flair, who the previous month at Unforgiven won the Intercontinental title, which I always thought was kind of strange, but hey, you know what? Gold around Rick's waist makes me smile. And Triple H gave him a beating, threw him through the fucking limo window, and it was a fucking mess, which led to another match on my fucking palette. This is amazing. Him and at Taboo Tuesday, mm-hmm. Him and Flair wrestled in the cage. Mm-hmm. So in the general sense of it, Andy, he recovered from the bad wrestling year of 03 because the opponents in 03 were not good. Scott Steiner, not ready.
Yeah.
Booker T was solid, but of course the storyline was so sadly overtly racist that it was just uncomfortable to watch. And then the feud with Kevin Nash was not horrible. It wasn't great, but it wasn't horrible. Mm-hmm. And then Goldberg was inevitable because I'm sure it was in his contract that Goldberg was supposed to get at least one world title reign, and he did.
Yeah.
And then the Orton stuff and the Benoit stuff, and he finally ended the feud with Shawn and all that. But by 05, it was obvious that Triple H was kind of transitioning into a much more mature role while guys were kind of moving in and out of the company. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, in those 2 years, I would say the best match was him and Batista at the Hell in a Hell in a Cell at Vengeance 05, and then him and Flair in the cage at Taboo Tuesday.
All right. So then we get the reunion that everybody was waiting for, because, you know, Shawn was healthy, he was back. Triple H was healthy-ish, he was back. You know, the sidebar. Now, there's a lot of talk about the sledgehammer. What do you think of the sledgehammer as his signature go-to weapon?
I liked it. Mm-hmm. The only bad part about it was you could tell it was always funny. It became like a running joke on TV, whether it was a real sledgehammer or a rubber-headed sledgehammer. Because if it was a real sledgehammer, he'd bang it on the steps, so you made sure it was metal. But when it was a rubber-headed one, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah, you could always see the way he would hold it, too. I think it was a little different.
Yes, yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. On a side note, Evolution, the line in the sand, the greatest entrance theme of all time. My opinion. And I had it number one. When I told you about the countdown show that Jordan Duncan used to do, that was my number one theme.
All right.
Love or hate Triple H, irrelevant, tremendous theme.
Tremendous themes. We still have one to talk about, which we'll get to soon. Shawn returns on Raw and reunited with Triple H to form DX, and their faces again. And this is when they were feuding with Vince, and a lot of memorable skits. And vignettes back, because when the Spirit Squad comes in, the mm-hmm. evil male cheerleaders, we have the infamous, where Vince comes out as Vince doing the Mr. McMahon walk, and that's where Shawn does the hysterical Shane dancing around on the
with the bad wig
Right. And then also you have the them dropping the shit in the ring on the Spirit Squad.
Yes.
That's another one of my my personal favorites. This is where this is kind of McMahon's Austin feud 2.0, where this got to those heights where he was just throwing everything at Triple H. DX embarrassed Vince over and over. Then you had Cyber Sunday where DX was feuding with Ray at RKO. And then, he ends up getting hurt again from, he tears another quad. So talk about the DX reunion and what you thought of that period of time.
Well, it was a good thing for the two of them because after he lost to Cena at WrestleMania 22 in Chicago, Triple H was kind of in a state of limbo, I guess. He was starting to get minor cheers again after, 4 years to heal. Mm-hmm. And then, meanwhile, Shawn was feuding with Vince, and they had that great street fight at WrestleMania when Shawn did the elbow off the ladder onto Vince, who was in the garbage can. This was a good thing to kind of get the fans pumped again. Obviously, cheap merch. And it distracted them from Cena needing to really establish himself, because Cena was – this stretch from 06 to like 08, Cena was getting a ton of shit as champion. So this was a chance for Cena to have the stage to himself without having Shawn around or Triple H around. The only bad part about it was, obviously, this is a different Shawn than the Shawn the first time. Mm-hmm. He was married. He had kids. He had found God. He'd become very, very faith-based, very religious. So the jokes were not as easy to do anymore, and he was really stringent to it. So it didn't have that same bite, and the gags were funny, but I remember talking about this with JR as well when we were going through them. It was funny when 20-something guys did it, but when 40-something-year-old guys do it or late 30s, it seems a little weird. So as much as I enjoyed seeing them come back and the shirts were rebought and stuff, it didn't seem to totally fit And the window for that was a lot smaller. Like, they went probably a couple months longer than they should have.
Yeah.
And his quad popping, the other quad that popped at New Year's Revolution 07, I don't want to say it was a blessing, but in the end, it made sense for DX to finish at this point. They had done most of the fun stuff in 06, and it was time for them to finish it. And the best match, probably that Hell in a Cell, was DX versus Shane, Vince, and Big Show, where they stick, I don't know if it was Vince or Shane's head in Big Show's big sweaty ass. that was probably the best match in 06, and that doesn't say much, but it was good. I mean, it was entertaining. But the bloom had fallen off the rose by that point. Mm-hmm. for them. Probably just because they were older.
Yeah. It was kind of like, you know, guys trying to relive their glory days, so to speak.
Exactly. Yep.
You know, this was a fun Attitude Era gimmick when you're all, you know, young and stupid. You know, it's like I hear sometimes, like, you know, it's like when I get together with my fraternity brothers, like, you know, yeah, you kind of regress and become that college dickhead. But, you know, which was funny for young 20-something-year-old guys. But, like, when you're in your 40s, you all have kids and all this stuff. Walking around being a dickhead, you know, it just doesn't have the same appeal. You know, it was fun then, but, you know, you don't need to go back. You have the memories. So, we have a, you know, he goes, like you said, he gets injured again. He tears the other quad, and he's out for a while. And he comes back, and, you know, comes back with new music, actually. This is the debut of another great theme, which he does use still to this day, depending on the situation. But that is King of Kings.
Behold the King, the King of Kings. On your knees, dog. From the place where the traitor lost both his name and his face.
Now, you say Evolution's the greatest. Now, so you would say this is number three behind Evolution in the game in terms of themes?
I like the King of Kings, actually. Not as much as Evolution or his regular everyday the game theme, mm-hmm. or his It's Time. That's still one of my favorites. Yeah. But I liked it. I liked it. It was different. It was like very different, kind of sing-songy, which is not a ton like their other themes, but his other themes. But I liked it. I liked it. And I like how, we'll get to it when he becomes an executive. But yeah. I liked it.
I like the you know, now, because of hindsight, but, you know, now when you hear, you know, if you hear the game or you hear King of Kings, you know which Triple H you're kind of getting.
Exactly.
You know, which is great. So we're looking at this is the 2008-2009 run where he comes back, and this is his big feud with Cena, basically, during this time. And you have guys like Kozlov and Jeff Hardy and Edge.
Orton,
they're all in.
He feuded with Orton a ton, mm-hmm. Yeah,
all up there. And then he has where he finally breaks character at this time. Admits that Vince is his father-in-law, Shane is his mm-hmm. brother-in-law, and Steph's his wife. And then this is all during the Orton feud, and this is when Orton goes and forms his own faction, Legacy. With Ted DiBiase and Cody Rhodes, and mm-hmm. And then culminates at WrestleMania 25, where Triple H defeats Randy Orton to retain the title, and then goes on to team with Shane and Batista at Backlash, and they lost after Orton pinned Triple H following a punt kick, and then he goes off TV for yeah. 6 weeks. And then he faces Orton in a three stages of hell match at the Bash. So talk about this time period where, you know, the whole, it's kind of like the next generation is starting to really peak in, and Triple H is getting into that Ric Flair time where he was the, you know, the one of the older elder statesmen, so to speak.
Yeah, he comes back at Backlash at SummerSlam in 07, and he goes through the end of 07. Cena pops his pec muscle, so now he gets into the world title picture. Orton wins it. Orton holds it for a while, all the way through into Backlash 08. Triple H wins it, holds a world title till Survivor Series, which I was at. I was at that Survivor Series 08 up in Boston. So he held the world. He was WWF champion. He was actually on SmackDown during this stretch, which was actually was different. And he feuded with Edge and a bunch of – at least in 08 for Triple H, he was wrestling different guys, so it was a little more variety. Then in 09, he goes back to Raw and he feuds with – Orton, and then, you know, the whole legacy thing. And he it was a solid run for him. He obviously was aging. Mm-hmm. And he was absolutely was in a different role. And it was solid. It was really solid. Not spectacular, but solid. His best feud was probably Orton. Mm-hmm. Best match? Hard to say. Him and Jeff Hardy had a good match at No Mercy 08, coincidentally, where last night's NXT was in Portland, Oregon. But it was just a stable stretch while the other belt was kind of going back and forth. And it was stable but not spectacular for Triple H. And Cena was with Edge and Big Show with the other belt with Vicky Guerrero and everything. So guys, this was a stretch, Andy, where guys were starting to grow up a little bit, and Cena was establishing himself as the face of the company, and Triple H was becoming more of an elder statesman again. Flair was gone. He had lost to Shawn at 24, so his career was over. Batista was back and forth as a face. It was pretty much a face, but he was solid on SmackDown without having to battle Triple. He was on SmackDown when Batista went over to Raw. So they kind of kept each other apart after that feud in 05. So it was a stable stretch, but nothing spectacular. Nothing stood out, but stable. Mm-hmm. That's a good way to explain that stretch.
Yeah, and then so he goes into his third run of DX, very famous episode with Sean. He goes, he's looking for Sean. He finds him at a cafeteria in Texas where he's working as a chef, and he wants him to come back to SummerSlam. And Sean says, "I thought it was Summerfest," making a joke at Jeremy Piven, who had referred to it that. And then
Summerfest.
Yes, I thought it was Summerfest. I think I cracked up that. And then Sean ends up, super kicking a girl off camera, and SummerSlam. He gets to team up with Triple H to face Legacy at SummerSlam that year, and they get they reunite officially, and they basically feud with Legacy for a little while, and then Cena, and then Jericho. So they actually have their first tag title reign. Can you believe that? And it took that long for Shawn and Hunter to actually to have the tag belts, and then they add Hornswoggle to the mix, and that was kind of interesting. And then they have the whole Mike Tyson thing with the he guest hosts Raw that night, teams with Jericho. At the end of the bout, Tyson turns on Jericho, aligning himself with Triple H and Shawn Michaels, and then they lost the tag titles to Show Miz in a triple threat match, also involving the Straight Edge Society. And then they had their last televised match on March 1st, which was a rematch for the titles. So talk about this period of DX. What did you think of this one?
I think this was more or less just to put over Legacy and put over the young guys and kind of help Orton along. 2010, clearly a forgettable stretch of wrestling, to be honest. And that's when you could tell that Sean was getting to the end of his, the end of his stretch. You know, he would end up kind of he would have the match with Taker at 25. Great, tremendous match. Get him out of the kitchen. And then by 2010, he's getting another match with Sean, and Hunter is working now with this young guy by the name of Sheamus. Mm-hmm. And him and Sheamus would have I don't want to say forgettable match at WrestleMania 26, but nothing that, you know, nothing to write home about. The tag feud was nice. They had that triple threat. It was Triple H, Sean, and Cena at Survivor Series 09. Mm-hmm. That was you know, it was pretty good. But there was no doubt that this incarnation of DX was strictly to put to feud with Legacy and to kind of, you know, fill the gap at the end of 09 before both those guys would go their separate ways. Sean would go back to the reigniting the feud with Taker, and Triple H would work with Sheamus. Mm-hmm. So I mean, here it was just simply a creative crutch, really.
Okay. And then, so we have another kind of change where we have I guess we want to call it the COO version of Triple H. You know, he started wearing the suits more. He would come out on February 21st, 2011 on episode of Raw. He interrupts the return of The Undertaker, challenges him to a match at WrestleMania 27, which later becomes a no-holds-barred match. He then attacks Sheamus with a pedigree. He ends up losing at WrestleMania 27 to The Undertaker, which at the time, Undertaker's undefeated streak went to 19-0. He was carried from the Undertaker was actually carried from the ring on a stretcher. Triple H was able to walk out. And then on July 18th, Triple H returns on behalf of WWE's board of directors to relieve his father-in-law, Vince, of his duties. That was followed by an announcement that he had been assigned to take over as the COO of the company. Now, this was during the CM Punk storyline when he had won the championship and left the company. Though a new champion was crowned, Triple H helped re-sign Punk and upheld both championship reigns. And then he announced he would referee a match to unify both championships at SummerSlam. And although he counted a pinfall on CM Punk to win, John Cena's leg was on the ropes, which would break the pin. Regardless, Triple H's longtime friend Kevin Nash attacked Punk immediately after the match to allow Alberto Del Rio to become the new champion. Triple H, though Nash and Punk demand a match against each other, Triple H fired Nash for insubordination and booked himself in a no DQ match at Night of Champions with his position of COO on the line. He won this match despite interference from John Laurinaitis, Nash, The Miz, and R-Truth. And then the majority of WWE's on-screen staff gave Triple H a vote of no confidence. Vince returned to relieve him of duties on Raw, and he remained COO, but he was replaced as general manager by John Laurinaitis. Once again, Nash attacked him during a tag team title match, against Miz and R-Truth at Vengeance. They announced that he had sustained a fractured vertebra, be out of action, returned on December 12th as part of the Slammy Awards. On December 18th, he defeated Nash at TLC in a sledgehammer match. And then, he comes back to evaluate John Laurinaitis' performance as general manager before he can announce the decision. He's interrupted by the returning Undertaker. And then Triple H accepted the challenge after being called a coward who lives in Shawn Michaels' shadow by the Undertaker on a condition that their rematch be contested in Hell in a Cell. And Triple H goes on to lose this match at WrestleMania 28. So what do you think of this new Triple H? This is the COO. You know, he wears a suit when he needs to, but then when he has to be, you know, facing the Undertaker, he comes out with that leather jean jacket combination. So talk about this period of time for the game.
Well, it was obvious that it was time for him to move on and take a more expanded role behind the scenes of the company. The roster was loaded now. He was not necessary for monthly shows anymore. You know, he was getting – he wasn't old or anything. He was what? He's only 69. He's only 4 years older than me. So he's, you know, in his – you know, in his
early 40s.
Mid-40s. Yeah, early to mid-40s. And you've got, you know, the company's got everybody loaded, you know, Cena, Punk, Del Rio, you know, all these. The roster's fine. So it was good for him to take this role and the whole thing with his dad, with his father-in-law. The matches with The Undertaker, I have both of them on my list.
If I had done a list, props to everybody who did list, by the way. Thank you so much on behalf of the site. For me, you know, as you could tell, like, you know, let's pull back the curtain a little bit. I have a bad memory, although I've been to a lot of these shows, and I do remember watching on TV. I can't retain a lot of this stuff. Maybe it was, you know, being a young father, whatever, at the time, a lot of this stuff. But, you know, I would have both those had I done a list, because those, from what I can remember, are legendary WrestleMania matches.
I think so. I know a lot of people think they're a little, you know, everybody accuses Triple H of being too self-serving in the everything had to be epic department. Well, when your only match is a WrestleMania, what the fuck are you supposed to do, you know?
Yeah. Oh, great.
That's when I get a little defensive
too.
Because I think people's, yeah, and that's sometimes where I'll admit I sometimes get a little defensive because I think people's reasoning for not liking things about him are illogical just for the sake of picking a fight. And I don't get that as much now as I did maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I don't get it as much now because obviously he doesn't wrestle anymore, really. So it's not as big a deal. But when he was wrestling, his matches were good. I will admit one misstep was the match with Punk at Night of Champions 2011. I don't know if that was a payback or just something to kind of help his feud with Nash get over. Because 2 months later, Punk would end up winning the title again, and then he'd hold it for over a year. So he didn't end up doing too bad out of the gate after the after that loss. But I think Punk probably should have won that match. Mm-hmm. The match with Nash at what is it, TLC 11?
Yeah,
I think it is fucking terrible. It's slow. It's clunky.
Well, it's Nash.
But he does get the rematch with Taker. And the Hell in a Cell at 28 in Miami, which I love that match. That's the lower of my two rankings. I think the Atlanta one's better. And then then we get the feud that I never thought we'd see, which is a feud with Brock Lesnar.
Yes.
I had going into that feud, Andy, I had the only documented on camera match between them, and that was the Global Warming Tour. Card they had in Australia,
Jesus,
which I believe our good friend Stacy I think was at, and that was a triple threat between Rock, Triple H, and Brock. It was right before SummerSlam that year, and I believe that is the only documented match between Triple H and Brock until that SummerSlam 2012. Then he comes back after the broken arm, and then they battle at 29, which I was at over here at MetLife. The match isn't bad because it's bad. It's bad because the stipulation didn't fit an 80,000 seat arena. They should have just had a match.
Yeah.
They tried to have a street fight, but a street fight in a big building, really not conducive, particularly to a live audience. Mm-hmm. The following month at Extreme Rules, they'd have a cage match. But That street fight stip at MetLife was rough. I'll even say that. It was rough to watch because it was not – street fights are not conducive to large buildings. I've always come to that realization. Same thing with last man standings. So obviously I was getting accustomed now to part-time Triple H because he was – you know, and I was trying to find new favorite guys. At the time, I was a big Punk guy. I bought a – I think I have more functioning – Punk shirts than I do Triple H shirts at the moment, which is pretty funny. But I would then get into the stretch where, and we'll talk about it with the next couple of chapters, but Triple H would then start getting yearly shirts to go with his yearly Mania feud. So I bought a few of those. But this 2 year stretch is definitely a big transition to part time, and he would start, you know, doing things behind the scenes. But when he did come out and wrestle, the matches were for the most part pretty good.
Yeah. Now, one big thing that happened at this time, wasn't this the haircut?
When yes,
he, you know, gone are the golden locks.
Yep.
And much like a lot of guys getting up there in age, you know, he basically comes out with a bald head and I think looks even more badass, than, you know, because
right.
he's got the goatee or the beard. And so what do you think of that? What do you think it was time, you know, for him to, you know, because eventually they all had to do it. There are a few guys like Edge who will cut it and it'll grow back. But a lot of guys, you know, once they lose it, you know, once they cut it, it's gone. Like, you know, it's
very jarring.
Yeah.
It was jarring when I first saw it. And he came back. Oh, that was, I guess, late January, early February of 13, because it was coming back from the broken arm and getting ready for the rematch of Brock at Mania. It was jarring, to say the least. Jarring. So you can say his official last match with the Triple H Golden Locks was SummerSlam 2012. And then he came back. And when he came back the following year, or the following January, he had the buzz cut.
Yeah.
It was jarring. I'm not going to lie. Well, when you're used to him having pretty much the same hair for, what, 17 years, it was a little jarring, yeah. But it fit actually. It showed. I don't want to say showed his age per se, but it showed his growth.
Yeah.
As a grizzled veteran and no longer the main event guy.
Yeah.
So I had no problem with it, but it was jarring at first. I will admit.
Yeah. The only one that's more jarring, I think, is Sean. You know, Sean wears them hats, but
Sean looks like an alien because his head's so bulbousy. Sean looks like, weak, I'm from France. Mm-hmm. You know, it's.
All right. So now we're up to about 2013, and this is the Authority era, where he announces in August of 2013 that he will be the special guest referee at SummerSlam in the WWE Championship match between John Cena and Daniel Bryan. Before attacking Brad Maddox with a pedigree. You know, Bryan wins the title. Triple H goes on to turn and attack Bryan with a pedigree, allowing Randy Orton to cash in his Money in the Bank, turning heel for the first time since 2006, along with his wife Stephanie. They create the Authority and with the Shield as his enforcers, and join Kane as director of operations. Kane joins them as director of operations. They kind of run roughshod over the WWE, and you know, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the days of the Union. I don't know if you remember that stretch. It was like, it was Test, Shamrock, Big Show,
and Foley.
Yeah, so that's what this kind of reminded me of, but it was like a better version, I guess, so to speak. You know, he starts feuding with anybody who basically stands against them, such as Big Show, Ziggler, Cody. He ends up, and then this is probably one of the greatest moments in wrestling, where he has his memorable entrance at WrestleMania 30, featuring Sasha, Charlotte, mm-hmm. and Alexa as a part of that entrance, where he every time I say it, my stupid device goes off. I gotta remember to unplug it when I do. Unplug when I do podcasts.
The run-in.
Mm-hmm. Yes, every time.
You have a Cal Ripken-esque stretch of the two of us on a podcast when Alexa starts yapping.
Last three, I think. So
more than that. But.
So, you know, Batista had come back also. And then Triple H faces Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania. And that gets Bryan wins that, gets into the triple threat match between Batista and Orton. He goes on to win the title that night. And then we go, Evolution comes back and they feud with the Shield, which turned on the Authority and became faces. Then Evolution, would lose to the Shield and at Extreme Rules, and then again at Payback. And on June 2nd, Batista would leave the group after Triple H refused to grant him a shot at the world title. Triple H would then resort to Plan B, which was another great angle where Seth Rollins turns. Talk about that for a second. Now, did you see that coming with Rollins, or were you like everybody else who was thinking Ambrose was going to be the one that turns? Because you knew somebody was turning.
Yes, somebody was turning. I thought it was going to be Ambrose too, but Seth just fit that role of being the sleazy backstabbing turd. So I think they made the better decision in the long run. Mm-hmm. Just to backtrack a little bit, I liked the Authority. I did not get the Authority T-shirt, and I do love the match with Daniel Bryan, also on my ballot. Although honestly,
I think
Andy,
it might be better if you say not on my ballot, because that would probably be less.
I gotta look at my ballot, but you know what's funny though, Andy? I have to look at my ballot. I actually think I have more Undertaker matches than I do Triple H matches. Yeah. Which as I was going along into my ballot, which please listen because it's a tremendous two part. I really put a lot of effort into it. I think it's one of the best things I've done. Cheap plug. So please check it out when you can. But anyway, the Evolution reunion. I remember I was writing Raw for the fine website, placemenation.com. I believe you've heard of it, Andy.
Yes, I have.
I was marking out like a fucking 10-year-old when Evolution reunited. And then that month, I went to Extreme Rules at IZOD. It was me, Armento, your pal there, the other Ionian, yep. Mm-hmm. Dr. G, and Mr. D'Amato. We went to Extreme Rules at IZOD, and that was the first of the back-to-back Evolution versus Shield matches. And just hearing Evolution's theme live again, I had people pointing at me, and I did the Orton. Oh, it was fucking great. I was a kid in candy store. I'm not gonna lie. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that was short-lived. That wouldn't have been good to go longer. The T-shirt they did that adapter perish with the skeletons. Not one of the company's best efforts with a T-shirt, but I do own it. I would have wished they just redid the laid, paid, and made. That's like one of my favorite T-shirts, and I can never find it. They need to put that in like the throwback section of the website. They need to bring back the Evolution shirt that said laid, paid, and made on it, because I thought that was always awesome. But the good thing about the Authority, Andy, was that it's Triple H, so everybody fucking hates him anyway. They all hate Stephanie too. So they're perfect bad guys. They might as well roll with it, right? You know?
Yeah.
And sadly, stop honking. What the fuck? Somebody's honking outside my house. Maybe it's Triple H's limo. I think had Daniel Bryan not gotten hurt, I think that storyline would have continued and got better. Mm-hmm. They obviously had to transition towards the end of the year in 2000, late 14, and that's when Sting came in. Yes. And then there's the Sting match at WrestleMania, which don't even get me started. Everybody fucking kills that. Chad wants to fucking cry. I don't know how to defend that. I just say, you know what? He wanted to beat him, and fuck it. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't give a shit. I have no conscience about it.
Yeah,
but I have no explanation, and that's fine.
It was what it was.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like you marking out was like when I went to Hulk Hogan Appreciation Night. I think it was the only time I heard the NWO theme live, because they had Hall and Nash come out during that show, and I was like,
"Oh, you know what? I don't think I ever have."
Well, okay, I never.
No,
I've only been to one WCW show in my life, and it was a house show at the Meadowlands. So yeah, I'd never, and I didn't go. I wasn't going when NWO was in WWF or WWE, whatever. And yeah, it was like I heard the NWO theme. I was like, "Oh my god!" I like literally like almost fell in my seat.
Yeah, no, it was awesome.
So I understand.
I don't think I've ever heard. I don't think I ever heard the NWO theme live, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think I have. That kind of blows. I wish I did.
So yeah, this was like you said, there Stephanie just gets heat no matter what, you know.
Precisely.
And you know, Triple H basically was taking. You know, he was the next Vince on camera. He was the next Vince because he could take the bumps. Vince, you know, as much of a beast Vince is, you know, the man is just, you know, in his 70s now, and he just can't do it. And Triple H still, you know, and the phrase best for business comes out. And I honestly, I like Triple H, believe me. You know, there were times when I would joke around and be like, oh great, God's going to win again. But, you know, the guy gets the business, he knows the business, and most of the time it is what's best for business. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, I understand he has his detractors out there, but the guy, you know, just whatever douchey stuff or whatever you thought politics might have happened earlier in his career, I think by what he's done backstage in the last however many years, totally makes up for it. Anybody who has anything bad to say about the guy, you see what he's doing now for the business, it's just insane. But let's continue on, though, this whole authority thing. Then, yes, the same thing happens, which was, you know, it was basically a WrestleMania moment where you got to see the two factions during the Monday Night Wars kind of get their hands on each other for the first time, really, which was DX and the NWO, which was kind of cool.
Oh, it was very cool.
But, you know, you're sitting there like which direction is Sean Waltman going in?
I know, right?
You know, and then the whole, then he has feuds later on. The authorities run goes to about, you know, what was that? Let me look at my sheet here. So that goes to about 2016, right? Where he returns, you know, he took a hiatus. He suffered some injuries, kayfabe, from Reigns. And then he returns for the match where they made Roman put on his title on the line. And he's the 30th entrant. He was unannounced. What'd you think of that, that rumble?
You really want an honest answer?
I do. That's what we're about here. I mean,
yeah,
this is, Scott, this is a safe place for you.
Oh, thank you. I don't want to see good old Will or fucking Hales kick through the fucking door.
Oh, Jerry Lawler was awesome. Was better than Triple H, you know that.
Yeah, because no one's better at walking around and yakking for 20 minutes before throwing a shitty punch. But anyway, see what you've done to me? You triggered me now. It was awesome. And you know why I loved it? Because everybody hated it. That's the only time in my – one of the few times in my life – in my Triple H fandom that I actually kind of took a kayfabe route, and I used to I posted pictures on Facebook, like past pictures of him with the belts, and there was somebody posted a picture of Triple H in 2000 and Triple H 2016 holding the belt with Stephanie standing behind him, and underneath it I typed, the more things change, the more things should stay as they are. I was such a fucking dick. Look, the whole premise of this, of the Rumble itself, and it was a good Rumble for the most part. It was a good Rumble as a match. Of course, you know, the big, I mean, the Triple H winning was nothing compared to the big debut. Obviously, that Rumble is more memorable for the debut of AJ Styles.
Yes.
Look, it was all down to, they wanted somebody. You remember, Vince was, by hook or by crook, was going to get Roman Reigns over, whether anybody liked it or not. Everybody got there. This is that couple year stretch, and I don't know how it is now today. It's kind of hard to gauge it, but this was a 2 year stretch where the company was fucking tired of the fans telling them what to do. I know it's a very odd situation because, you know, those fans want the product, but they listened to the fans whining and switched up the storyline in 2014 to cater for Daniel Bryan, and they weren't wrong. It had to be done. Mm-hmm. Then the next year they wanted to do it again. And now the fans think, well, if we just boo Roman Reigns enough, they'll just fire him or whatever, and we can get rid of him and have all the little guys wrestle. And at that point, I think Vince is like, you know what? It's my company, and there are some people that like Roman, so tough shit. So they might as well get the one guy that everybody would fucking hate to be champion to face him at WrestleMania in Arlington, and that ended up being Triple H. The only bad part about it was that WrestleMania is like 47 hours long, and that main event's like 49 hours long. So unfortunately, it wasn't executed. It should have been a squash. I can't believe I'm actually saying that. But as a show as long as that was, Roman Reigns should have come down and beat the fucking crap out of Triple H in like 3.5 minutes. Instead of having a long – this is where the whole gratuitousness does hurt. Because instead we get a long, you know, what, I don't know how long it was, probably 23, 24 minutes. Not necessary whatsoever. Roman Reigns should have come down, and Triple H should have just laid down and took a fucking beating like the old man he is, and Roman should have won like that instead of having this long, drawn out, you know, 25-minute affair.
Yes.
Having said that, it was a perfect guy to do that at the moment. There was nobody else in the company. There was nobody else on the roster or on the company hated enough to try to cheer Roman more than him. So he bit the bullet, won the title, got ready for that match, put over Roman, and then Roman would end up having actually a decent couple months. Him and AJ would actually have a couple back-to-back great pay-per-view matches.
Yes, I remember that.
But that's what their thinking was. Whether you agree or disagree is obviously everybody's opinion. But at the time, they thought that he was the best heel to put Roman over in that position. Mm-hmm.
The match
like
was
it or not.
27-11.
Yeah, it should have been like 11.
I mean, Maisley was only the second longest on the card.
Well, yeah, because the other self-serving match, Shane and Taker, was longer.
It was 30 minutes and 5 seconds.
Yeah, that's another argument for another day.
Yeah.
Whoever does the Taker episode of this show is going to have to try and defend that one.
Yeah, have fun with that one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, there's nobody else in that spot that could have done it at that time. You could agree or disagree. That's everybody's entitled to their opinion. But my opinion is, at the time on the roster, there was nobody else hated enough to put over Roman, unless it was Seth, if Seth was healthy. That's the problem. Seth got hurt.
Yeah.
If Seth hadn't blown his knee out, it would be him in that role.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, circumstance kind of forced it, really.
Right. So we're looking at, you know, the end of an era, basically, where he's becoming a part-timer. You know, he shows up for WrestleMania season, which, you know, I honestly don't have a problem with. You know, it's a huge card. You know, we talk about last year's WrestleMania, which was 36, which you and I were both in attendance for the match with Batista. And I thought that was an okay feud.
It was fine.
I mean, I thought Batista was going to get his win that night, but he obviously didn't. And I have a picture of you in the middle of MetLife with nobody else standing. And you're just up there with your arms up in the air because we were a section or so away from each other.
Yep.
So that was a very weird.
Thank you for marking that moment in time. I appreciate.
Yes,
it.
I do. That was that whole Road Warrior thing going
yeah.
on. Yeah, that was kind of odd. Where would you rank his Mania entrances with the ones that had all the pomp and circumstance to them?
I think my favorite one, my two favorites, I always love the Conan one at 22, mm-hmm. and I love the Terminator one at 31.
Yeah, I remember that one.
I think those are my two favorites.
Okay.
I think those the fucking giant unicycle thing or tricycle thing is with Stephanie sitting on it or whatever is a little weird, but
yes.
Yeah, no, I think the Conan, and obviously not counting the earlier ones where, you know, where Lemmy and Motorhead sung his theme, those don't count because those are marked in time. But I would have to say my two favorites are Conan at 22 and Terminator at 31. Those are probably my two favorites.
All right. So he continued on some of his authority stuff with the Survivor Series and back in 20 – I'm trying to read my notes here – back in 2016 where it was he was the fifth member of Team Raw. You know, Kurt Angle was about to win the match, but Triple H pedigreed him, which led to Angle's elimination, kind of reigniting an old feud from years ago. And what do you think of the Triple H Kurt feud over the years?
You know what's funny? They were one of the few pairs that didn't have, like, if you talk about Andy, all of the big main eventers in Attitude Era history. Mm-hmm. Some guys had great chemistry and some guys didn't. Triple H and Kurt, Austin and Kurt had great chemistry. Rock and Kurt had great chemistry. Triple H and Kurt had chemistry. Their pay-per-view matches were not the greatest. Rock and Taker did not have great chemistry. Austin and Taker had great chemistry. Austin and Triple H had great chemistry. But the Kurt Triple H matches were not the best. I think the problem there was a lot of the match between the two of them had a lot of outside crap involved, whether it was Stephanie or mm-hmm. Vince or whatever. And I think it took away from their matches specifically. So the feuds were good, but their matches were not as good as when they were both of them were facing other people. So I will say that.
So what do you think of the whole Ronda Rousey stuff?
I loved it.
You know,
I loved it.
You know, they came in and, you know, she came in with The Rock and Mania. What was that? 31.
At Levi. Yep.
Okay. And then it led to the, you know, the her debut match at 34, where it was the mixed tag, where, you know, you could definitely see Triple H now. Everything he does is for the business. You know, he's not putting himself over, you know, unless it serves a storyline, you know. And now he's kind of like, you know, transitioned to, you know, the leader of arguably the number one brand in terms of work rate, storylines, fan reception, which is NXT. What do you think how he's transitioned into this role and the job he's doing down there, Full Sail?
I think he's doing a tremendous job. Mm-hmm. He has gotten the company to embrace NXT as a brand now and not just a feeder system. Mm-hmm. It's not just a you know, AAA where everybody, we had to see good guys for 2 years and then automatically they're back on, you know, they're on they're on Raw or SmackDown, and then everybody gets pissed off. So I think he's done a good job of cultivating talent. I think he's always wanted to have something like that, particularly in this company. Mm-hmm. He's had some missteps. Sin Cara, probably one of his biggest missteps.
Yeah. Vince had, you know, Luger and some other failures. If you go back through Vince's time, you know, guys that he just couldn't get over, you know, no matter what. I mean, Luger came in with such fanfare, but, you know, fizzled out under him. You know, guys, there were other guys, you know. So Triple H, yeah, not everybody bats 1,000, basically. That's what I'm trying to, what my interruption was about.
Yeah, exactly. you're exactly right. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
He's just done a tremendous job of cultivating the talent and really, really growing the company by leaps and bounds. I think particularly Vince kind of focusing on the XFL, which has had a good first 2 weeks, by the way, as of this recording. But now there's rumors that they, you know, all of them don't want to do wrestling anymore, which I just can't see happening. Wrestling is in Triple
H's
blood.
I don't really believe that.
I don't believe that at all. Triple H wants to run this company. There's no doubt about it. I wouldn't say he doesn't want to sell this at all. Maybe Vince wants to sell it to him or just keep it in the family. But I cannot see WWE being owned by Disney or fucking Fox or something. That's just nonsense. That's mm-hmm. nonsense. I'll believe it when I see it.
Now we have NXT. We have NXT UK. Do you think we're going to see, is he going to be able to, can he establish NXTs across the globe, basically? Will we see an NXT Japan, an NXT India, an NXT Brazil, an NXT Australia, which are probably the top territories I think they'd like to get to? Do you think he has that in him?
I sure he does. I don't think we'll see. We're easily able to get NXT Australia. Mm-hmm. NXT Japan, I think they'd be better off working a deal out with New Japan, really, than cultivating, unless they take over like Noah or one of those other Japanese promotions that might be struggling or being swallowed up by New Japan. Otherwise, I just make a deal with New Japan then, which ultimately is what I think they should do. I think they should work with New Japan.
Or even NXT Mexico, even too.
They have Rey.
yeah.
on the roster, and Ray is a big guy down in AAA and CMLL, so that's possible. Mm-hmm. Right now, I think they really like focusing on that Northern European audience. As the big announcement last night at as of this taping the other night at NXT TakeOver was that the next NXT UK show is in Dublin. Is in Dublin, Ireland on, I think it's the 26th of April. So I think they're enjoying expanding in Europe. I think we'll see more more stuff in Europe, maybe Germany. I think they really want to expand in Europe. Japan, I think, is an interesting situation because I think I think they'd be better off just trying to work something out with New Japan or one of the other promotions there. Australia, I think, is a good possibility. After that, I think it depends on the amount of talent. Brazil – I mean, I'm not experienced. I'm not going to pretend to know like the background on that, but I don't think they want to spread things that thin. Mm-hmm. My opinion, but I definitely could see them doing Australia. I could definitely see them expanding into Ireland and Scotland as part of NXT UK, which they kind of are already. Japan is the wild card.
Yeah,
as to where to go from there, whether they want to do an NXT Japan. Or if they want to work something out with New Japan, because I think that's a better option, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's you know, kind of in the home stretch here to close out. What do you think his legacy will be in ring, behind the scenes? How will he be remembered?
He'll probably be one of the most polarizing personalities in the history of the business, even more polarizing than probably Roman Reigns. It will not be denied that A, he was a great wrestler in his prime. B, he was involved in some questionable creative decisions. C, he will forever be thought of as the guy who married into the company, which is a fact, but I don't think he did that. I think he loves Stephanie. They have three wonderful daughters. So, I mean, he wants the family. But he loves wrestling, and NXT has kind of helped fix his public image a little bit. But in terms of in-ring, a lot of people – that's probably the most galvanizing part of it. His executive decisions no one's going to question because we're not in that spot. But he's probably one of the most galvanizing, polarizing – wrestlers of all time, because you'll have camps. I'm not the only one who's a big Triple H fan, but
no, just the biggest one I know.
Who, yeah, I'm just the only one that anybody knows. I think a lot of people like Chad. I love Chad to death, but Chad, not a Triple H fan, and that's fine. Others are fans, so you know you're. He's either a great wrestler or he's a guy who got lucky with good opponents, which that I will admit that reasoning pisses me off, because you need two to tango, period. Mm-hmm. Quote, carry. The only carry job I ever really saw in my life was Bret Hart carrying British Bulldog at SummerSlam 92. That's a carry job. Yeah. Triple H never had anything like that. He couldn't even, I mean, the Scott Steiner match, the Rumble, they barely could carry each other. Triple H wasn't in a good physical state to carry anybody then. But he will be remembered as a polarizing personality. He will be remembered as helping WWE win the Monday Night War. DX will go down as one of the greatest factions of all time. Evolution will go down as one of the greatest factions of all time. Time will tell on his legacy as an executive after Vince is gone. Mm-hmm. Although Vince might be a cyborg, so who the hell knows? Vince might outlive all of us, but I think his legacy as a wrestling executive will be written when he's calling the shots on his own. Mm-hmm. Whenever that may be, who the hell knows? That's what I think. In terms of his as character and as a wrestler, he is definitely one of the most polarizing of all time. You either there's no in betweens. I've never heard anybody say what do you think of Triple H? He's all right. No, it's either me or everybody else when it comes to Triple H. You're never going to get a lukewarm. Cena's the same way. Mm-hmm. Cena's the same way. And I flipped on Cena. I from like 05, probably like 06 to 10, I fucking hated Cena. But I've gone a complete 180 on Cena, and he's one of my favorites now. So people win you over, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think his legacy as a wrestler will always be polarizing. His legacy as an executive has yet to be written.
Okay.
So time will tell.
Any final thoughts on Triple H? Like, you know, any matches, you know, you want people to watch? Any, shows? Any, you know, suggestions?
Well, I would definitely watch, and I mentioned this on my reveal show, the Triple H matches I think a lot of people forget and are really good is SummerSlam 98 with The Rock, the ladder match.
Mm-hmm.
The match with Flair at Taboo Tuesday 05 in the cage. And I actually had our good friend Sean Kidd watch earlier today the match with Austin at No Way Out 01. I think those three matches are like his cornerstone matches of his career. Those three and the Hell in a Cell with Batista. Those are like, to me, the four quintessential Triple H matches for me. Like, if you want to watch four awesome Triple H matches, those are the four to watch for me. Those are the ones I recommend. And yes, Katie Vick was a mistake. And no one, of course, wrestling fans don't let anybody not live anything down. Katie Vick will be remembered forever. And the kind of senseless creative nonsense of the Booker T storyline. But there's hiccups in any, and you, this won't be the only time, Andy, with your future guests of whoever is chosen. Everybody has a creative black hole or a hiccup somewhere. It happens. Mm-hmm. So, but those are the four matches that I always tell people to watch when they say, what's a good Triple H match to watch? Any of those four for me. It's always good, easy choices.
All right. Awesome. Well, I want to say thank you for being here on my inaugural episode talking about your favorite wrestler. I really appreciate that.
It. It's a lot of fun.
We've mentioned your shows throughout there, but you know, what can people hear more of your work at here at Place to Be Nation?
Oh, I'm everywhere. You could check me on Twitter at PTB Podfather. I'm always talking about stuff. Here on the wrestling feed, of course, the mothership, the gold standard, myself and my PIC, Mr. Rosero, the Place to Be podcast. Myself, Steve Willey, and Nate Milton, and whatever guests join us for Place to Be Nation's main event. You could check that out every other Friday morning. It drops on placebnation.com and the wrestling feed. Jenny and the Gems, myself, Jennifer Smith, Matt Souza, Drew Wardlaw. We dive into the hidden gems section of the WWE Network, and we pick out something fun and bizarre and unusual and weird, and watch it and discuss it. I particularly would like you to watch the last episode we did about the two AWA shows, because those will just blow your mind. Do I have anything else on the wrestling?
Reaction shows, chain reaction.
Oh, reaction shows. Yes. I usually handle most reaction shows. You can see me in and out now. But over on the
did you talk about MWA Power?
Power. Thank power. You. I got to start getting accustomed to that now because it's new. But join myself and the doctor, Dr. G. George Bellino, every Saturday morning that drops on the website for your NWA Power recap. Of course, NWA does the show on Tuesdays on YouTube. We give everyone a couple days to watch the show and formulate opinions. Then you can hear us do the recap and get you ready for the Crockett Cup and other great. And new shows are debuting on NWA down the line, so stay tuned for that too. Now I think that's everything.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can catch me on any individual shows like this fine program that I think is going to be exceptionally great, Andy, from here on out on leaps and bounds.
Thank you.
When it comes to polarizing figures, you've already gotten the hard one out of the way. It's gravy from here on out.
On the pop feed,
you, me, the doctor, and Mr. D'Amato for the year in pop. I don't know when this show is posting, but we have a great episode in the hopper. Mm-hmm. It'll probably be out by the time
it will be out. Yeah.
Yeah. So check that out. It's a great show. I'm always with you on Looking Forward, Looking Back. I always have you, me, the ladies, Timmy. Mm-hmm. We have a fun bunch. I love our Looking Forward, Looking Back bunch.
Yeah.
I think we have a good time.
It's quite the dynamic.
It really is. I've never enjoyed a Michael Cera movie better than the Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yes, that'll be up at some point.
Yeah, I should remember most of it at some point.
Yes.
Stay tuned for that on the pop feed. You'll enjoy that. And on one of our sister feeds, is that it for me on the pop feed? Yeah, I think it is.
I think so, yeah.
And then, of course, on one of our sister feeds, Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position, which is a tremendous feed, you can check me here on Journey into Infinity. Myself, Tim, JR, and myself, we're going through the MCU library, checking out all 23.
I think around
something like
there.
That. Yeah, 23, 24 MCU movies and talking about them. So I'm on all three of these awesome feeds. Again, follow me on Twitter at PTB Podfather. And I take Triple H criticism, as long as you're nice to me, I take any Triple H criticism. I enjoy debating it. It's a lot of fun. Just be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Be sensible. That's all I ask.
Be respectful.
Be respectful. Don't be a dope.
Respect other
people. Don't
be a troll. No, it's all about, the one thing we love about The Nation is that, we don't always all get along. And when we disagree, we debate and we discuss. We don't just sit there and, crap on each other.
Throw bombs. Exactly.
Yeah, throw bombs. That's really what bonds us is our ability to enjoy products together, but then also to disagree on things, because then that leads to great discussions and, you get to hear some fun opinions and reasonings. And some are a little out of left field and others are grounded. So that's what we love here at The Nation. So if you want to talk Triple H, Scott's your guy. As for me, with my shows, this is my debut as a host on the Wrestling Feed. I have another show, kind of a spinoff. Scott, you were kind enough with Nate to allow me to bring The Great Debate, one of my shows on the pop feed, over to The Main Event.
But now
we have decided to spin it off into its own thing. So look for the debut episode of The Great Debate Wrestling Edition. Joining me on that maiden voyage will be Mr. J.R. Serino D'Amato, Tim Capel, and Matt Souza. So that should be a lot of fun.
What a motley bunch.
Yes. Yes, I have a feeling.
You're going to have a blast on that show.
I have a feeling that's going to be said about every episode when you see the pairings that I come up with. That's part of the fun of hosting shows here, is not only talking to the guys, but looking,
exactly,
trying to get those matchups that are going to get some good conversations. Also, over on the pop feed, I have several shows. Scott, like mentioned, the Year in Pop. Those are awesome. Come about every 6 weeks. Check out Looking Forward, Looking Back. Those come as movie seasons come and go. Our big episode is the summer movie preview, so look for that coming in the next month or two. Also, The Great Debate, which is my pop and sports edition, as well as Laughing Theater, which is my live watch of comedy movies. New episodes coming about twice a month. So check those all out. Go to placemanation.com. Don't forget to like our tournament page. By the time you're listening to this, the sitcom tournament will probably have come to an end, and we'll be in our next tournament, which will be the best or greatest sports logo, North American. It's a very wonky title, but of 2020. Basically, we're looking to see what everybody's favorite logo is between Major League Baseball, National Hockey League, and NFL, and NBA. So check it out. It's going to be a nice palate cleanser till we get to our next tournament, which will be announced down the line on the Place to Be podcast. So once again, I want to say thank you to the Podfather, Scott Criscolo, for joining me on the debut voyage of The Evolution. Not sure who will be our next subject or the next guest, but check us out. We expect to be back in the beginning quarterly, but who knows what happens down the line. For Scott Criscolo, I'm Andy Athan. Thank you for joining me here on The Evolution. We'll see you next time.